染めない夢
What is up, everybody? You're listening to the Talk of Spirit Anime Cast. My name is Andrew, and I'm joined here with Chris.
Yo.
Today's episode is our part two of our summer 2022 anime season first impressions. I want to say reviews. It's all done. Everything's over with. It's time to give our reviews, everything. No. This episode, we have My Isekai Life, the maid I hired recently is mysterious, Parallel World Pharmacy, Yakuza's Guide to Babysitting, Luminous Witches, Phantom of the Idol, Classroom of the Elite Season 2, Shadow House Season 2, Call of the Night, Rent a Girlfriend Second Season, The Devil is a Part-Timer Second Season, Overlord Season 4, Orient Part 2, A Couple of Cuckoos, technically the Second Core, we'll talk about that, Prima Doll, Lucifer and the Biscuit Hammer, Extreme Hearts, Danmachi Season 4, Futopai, and Aoashi, again, going into the Second Core. So, yes, as usual, a lot to go through. I don't know that these ones will have as much discussion as the last episode, so hopefully it's not 5 hours long, but we'll see. Again, I think we're going to move to three parts for the first impressions. I gotta. Let's start with our first one. Get things started. As usual, from otakuspirit.com, that's where you can go for all of our stuff there. Social media links, Discord link, and also ways that you can support us, which a bunch of lovely other people have, and we greatly appreciate it. We have a Patreon. We have a tips link, all that good stuff there at otakuspirit.com. We also have a shop, shop.otakuspirit.com, where you can get some merch. But yeah, let's start. My Isekai Life. Are you excited for this one?
Yes.
That time I didn't get reincarnated as a slime, as Andrew likes to joke about. It's my Isekai Life. I gained a second character class and became the strongest sage in the world. I don't know if I want to read that. Again, I think people like when I read the Japanese title just because they want to see me flub it. Tensei. Yeah, it's Tensei. I almost said Tensai. Tensei Kinja no Isekai Life. Dainai no Shokugyo wo ette Sekai... Saikyo ni narimashita. That's it. I said that last part like I'm going to go into another line because I assumed it was going to go two lines. Streaming on High Dive, run for 12 episodes, done by Studio Reveroot. Source is a light novel. Genres are action, adventure, fantasy. And the director is Keisuke Kojima, who did Babylon assistant director work. So, and also the creator behind this one's original source material is Shoto Shinko, who was obviously known for creating Strongest Sage with the Weakest Crest. So this guy has an obsession with sages.
Yeah.
Obviously. But this isn't... The other one wasn't a set guy, technically. It was a rebirth, right? Yeah, it was a rebirth.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, they're the same thing. This one follows a guy named Yuji. And Yuji has been essentially... What was it? He was... Yeah, that's right. It kind of jumps around how it plays out the story. But at some point, you learn that he was in our time. He was a hardworking... It kind of gave the sense that he was, you know, like at a black company or something like that. Yeah. Overworked and
worked
stuff like that.
Worked himself to death.
And it kind of jumps to where he wakes up in this fantasy world where he doesn't know what's going on. But he goes to get up and he touches a slime and it ends up taming it. Kind of find out he's got like a status screen just like a... It's almost video game-esque type of isekai. And the screen tells him that he's a tamer and all that kind of stuff. And then eventually he follows the slime over to some random, like, building in the middle of the forest that has a ton of books. And he opens the books and it gives him skills. Like, he doesn't even have to read it. Just he opens the book and skill acquired. Well, a whole bunch of slimes show up. And he tames them all, and they all open up all the books, and he just learns everything that the slimes open up and gets a whole bunch of skills and stuff. And over time, it kind of jumps to him saving some town from, like, a flood of, like, 1,000 monsters. And you get an idea of what makes Yuji special. In this world, tamers are the worst. Nobody wants to party a tamer. He's, like, the weakest of weaks. But he's special in the idea that his unique skill that he has is a transfer ability. He's able to transfer skills to his tames. So he's got all these slimes out in the middle of this field area that's being swarmed by all these monsters. And he's able to skill transfer to them so they can cast spells. Because he has, like, a really high ability of magic. Like, his spells are insanely powerful. And it jokes about the idea that he can do incantationless. But if he does do the incantation, it actually is super strong. So yeah, he just sits there and transfers spells to all of his minions, and they take out stuff. So that's kind of what makes Yuji special. And he does claim that he has tracking ability, which is very, wanted by parties, but it's just really him sending out his pets to look at the area ahead of him. So yeah, he saves that one town, and then he disappears in the middle of the night so that he doesn't get attention. And then he goes to another town where he gets a party to go out to find this stone dragon. He ends up finding the stone dragon, kills the stone dragon, goes back to the guild house where he's pulled into, like, a meeting where everybody has discovered there's this big, huge dragon that appeared, this big blue dragon, and it's part of some prophecy. And so happens, there's also this prophecy that, like, what was it, 30 years prior, they had did a summoning spell that would happen a week ago, which was the time that he showed up. So it kind of implies that he was summoned by these people 30 years ago to deal with this threat. So that's where I've gotten. I think I've missed one or two episodes, but your thoughts on that time I didn't get reincarnated as a slime?
I think that this world has some interesting tidbits as far as systems that go into play with it. Like Andrew was mentioning, the whole him transferring his abilities to his tames or whatever have you is a really cool and interesting system. I'm at this point where it's at this point where I want to see where it goes from this point, but at the same time it's just right there at the surface level of semi interesting because it's got some interesting tidbits for its systems, but the one of the biggest problems that I have with this is that it doesn't like to limit him. The main character with its rules that it's imposing.
Minus 5,000 mana. I'll use it again.
That's the exact thing that off the top of my head that is the most obvious of all of them is what the heck is the point in having a restriction of MP if he can just go past his MP limit? Yeah, it seems like he ends up going into practically a coma for like 3 days afterwards if he uses that.
No, they literally were celebrating that night. So I think it was that day, wasn't it?
I don't know. It seems like
I don't know why they would take 3 days before they celebrated, because they were celebrating when he woke up.
Yeah, he definitely, it seemed like he was sleeping for a while, and they kind of implied it was for a while, but at the same time, it doesn't matter. They're picking and choosing when they want to enforce that rule. So it doesn't really even matter. My point is that these rules are very, very flimsy, and that's my frustration with it. Even when it comes to like his sage power, it's kind of cool at certain points, but at the same time, it's like because I need him to do this, so I'll just let him use a hellfire thing that technically he can't use. It's just that he has knowledge of it because of all those books that he read, but he can force it through his slimes, and so therefore he can use it. And it's like, okay, so you gave him an OP power, but it technically he can't use it. You're just making rules up as you go. So it's one of those things. I like it because the system is very interesting. For a tidbit, another aspect of it that I do really like is that he seems to be mixing and matching spells. So he kind of uses this, and then he'll go through his, it shows him all these screens up in the air, and he's basically pulling these spells together and mixing them together to come up with.
He makes like
goal.
A command center, like it, yeah. when it showed in that first scene where like again like thousand things come to the town. Everybody's like out there fighting in the middle of it, and he just goes up the top of this building in the middle of the town and just like lays out this spread of like 50 monitors in front of him, and he's just kind of throwing stuff around and command. He creates a command center basically. That's technically the only time he's done that. I mean, he's done that other places, but it's usually kind of he's more involved. But yeah.
But yeah, it's one of those things. There's a lot of cool stuff in here, but at the same time, it's right now at this point where it's like I could continue going. It seems fun and very interesting, and I'd like to see where it goes from here.
Yeah, I think the biggest killing point of this show, well, there's two killing points of the show. One, I did find the whole skill transfer thing very interesting. It's a unique thing to give to an OP main character. It gives another level to it. It's not that he's directly attacking things. He does, but for the most part, he's just kind of sending his wolf with the slimes on top of it out in front of him, and they're basically like a tank that he's sending out that shoots his spells for him. So it's almost like he has like a sentry that he can send out before him. So it's a different take on an OP main character. It's not him out there fighting, which is definitely interesting. But the problem is that I am so sick of hearing spell transfer. Every 2 seconds, spell transfer over and over again for what I think I watched 4 episodes, something like that. It got so repetitive. I was like, oh, I don't want to hear him say that no more. Just assume that I know that he's spell transferring. You don't have to say it. I can just imagine I don't know. Maybe they made the say you say it once and they just keep repeating it over and over again. But the other problem that this show has is that the main character is so boring. Like, he is so boring. Now, he could possibly get some development. It could be me being critical of it when, in fact, it is really just a byproduct of what he was. He was this, you know, this hard worker. He was a Sachiku. He just sat there and did nothing but work all day. And I do like the fact that they do reference that. Like, on a regular basis, whenever, like, the party's having a little bit of argument, he's like, oh, yeah, that's usually what leads to projects not being done. He reflects back on these meetings that he used to have all the time where people would argue about the situation and it would never get resolved. It's dumb things, but at least he's reflecting on his past life. And maybe that's why he's so boring. Like, he is such a boring main character. And the only thing that can really possibly save it was the fact that they added obviously these very goofy little slimes that are really his character. The characters are really in the slimes. And then he gets his party with Lisa and Tina, and I didn't really get too much out of them and what I have watched, because they just kind of showed up in the last 2 episodes, and he didn't really do anything with those two characters. I mean, one was kind of bubbling, one was a little bit more duty bound, I guess you would probably call it, but
left him behind.
There's just there. Yeah. He any kind of development he has with certain characters, he just leaves behind, which I understand, because I mean, I would probably want to leave too, because a nation or something, knowing that you have the ability to make, you know, 50 slimes create a huge dragon breath is probably something that the kingdoms aren't going to like this dude can literally not wipe out a nation with that spell. So I can see him being, but they know who he is. He's still going to the Adventure Guild. They know where he's going. It's not as if he's trying to hide his identity or anything like that. He's pretty obvious about what he's doing. Word will get out. But I don't know. The main character is really, really boring. And the show, besides like the unique mechanic, is just very basic isekai fare. Overpowered main character stuff. So, again, unique setup, but standard isekai fare. Overpowered main character that's extremely boring. So,
and slimes are probably the most entertaining thing.
I've never really been too into the slime things, the cute slime thing, but I can see people really enjoying that as like the mascot characters that are being goofy. I was very interested to see how, because they've showed how he found the slimes, obviously. They haven't showed how Proud Wolf came into his group, and they haven't showed the Dryad. The Dryad came out of nowhere.
They did show the Dryad.
So I was kind of interested to see how she joined the party, but either way, I can't at this point recommend it. Revroot's doing a really good job of it, which is kind of surprising. I don't know that Revroot has done anything like spectacular in the past, but they're doing a decent job with this show, honestly. So there you go. We'll see if it turns anything special, but so far it's just very standard so far. So My Isekai Life, check that out if that's interesting to you. The maid I hired recently is mysterious, or as everybody's calling it, sus maid. I call it tan maid, but sure, call it sus maid. Saiken Yatata maid ga Ayashi. This one is streaming on Crunchyroll, running for 11 episodes, done by Studio Blade and Silverlink. The source is a manga. The genres are comedy, romance, slice of life. And, of course, the creator behind this one is Wakame Konbo, who did The Great Jahi Will Not Be Defeated. As well as pretty much most of the team and the studio is everybody that worked on The Great Jahi Will Not Be Defeated. So, also the director Mirai Minato, who's also worked on Fate Collide Liner Prisma and Masamune Kun's Revenge. So, pretty solid team if you enjoyed Jahi-sama. But yeah, this one follows a guy named Yuri, and Yuri has recently lost his parents to a, yes, that tragic car accident that takes out all of parents. but anyways, I don't know, maybe I'm thinking it's like a trend for bookchans, maybe. Those, you stay away from cars if you're a family that's rich and has a mansion. But anyways, Yuri, in losing his parents, he decides, you know, this is my family. Like, this is my family right, is this mansion. Even though it's like a smaller mansion compared to most noble families or whatever, he still cherishes it because it's like his, that's where his family was. So he wants to keep it up. And unfortunately, his family wasn't too rich, so he's got to get rid of all of his butlers, all of his maids, kind of downsize quite a bit in order to keep the house going. And he wants to, again, he wants to make it that his home. He wants to make sure he keeps it. And as he's trying to do what all the maids and butler did, cleaning and everything like that, and cooking, he's obviously failing miserably because he's just kind of a dumb kid. At some point, when he's at the end of his wits, a knock comes at the door, and there's Lilith, a maid, who says, "Hey, I want to be your maid. Let me be your maid." He's like, "I can't pay you, and I don't want it. You gotta go. I can't afford you, whatever." She's like, "No, that's all right. I'll do it for free. I just want to be a live-in maid. Basically have a place to stay in here." And after his tummy growls, he finally decides, okay, sure, whatever, even though you're extremely suspicious that you showed up and all this kind of stuff. Ayashi! Yep. So yeah, he decides to let her be a stay-in maid, and so she cooks and takes care of him on a daily basis. And all the while, he is extremely suspicious of her because she's very gorgeous, her eyes are very beautiful, she's very attractive, she cleans all of his clothes perfectly, they smell great, his food tastes delicious. How can it taste so delicious? Oh, why is she up all night in the kitchen? She must be making poison, all this kind of stuff. And yeah, your thoughts?
I love the show because of how goofy it is. I mean, the only thing that is kind of annoying about this is the Ayashi. I'm so tired of hearing him go, "Ayashi."
Which is going to be pretty much most of the show.
It is. It's going to be the whole show, and that's, I know, quirk. It. But it is. It's goofy. It's fun. His reactions to everything she does is fantastic. All the how much he throws her off is absolutely fantastic. Basically, I've been having a lot of a blast with this show. It's so much fun. It's so goofy.
I was kind of surprised how forward that would end up being, because I kind of assumed it would be just her obviously doting on him and then him just being suspicious. But he's very forward about what he thinks of her. Like, She'll say something like, "Yo, yeah, I put some great I put love inside of the food," because he's thinking that she poisoned it or something like that. She's like, "Yeah, I put a love potion in it," and he's like, "That must be exactly why I'm so attracted to you, and you're so gorgeous and everything." And then she just freaks out. Like, I just love how it's very two sided. It's not just one sided. It's her doting on him and him being a dumb. Well, he is a dumb brat kid. That is the shtick, and so it's kind of one of those things where, yes, I'm coming into this because I think Lilith's character design is absolutely perfection. Like, it's Tan Girl. She's got two moles on the eye, because obviously one is not enough.
One love mark.
She's got one on her chest, and my joke that I made in my video was, we don't know how many other moles that she's got. She's got the tan skin, perfect complexion, those gorgeous eyes, which I kind of seen in Jahi-sama Will Not Be Defeated. Like, this character designer just nails eyes, and the studio is doing a great job with it. So she's got just a great design to her, and that was the appeal. And so the problem that I'm having right now is that I can't really recommend the show unless you just like how gorgeous Lilith is, because that's pretty much most of the show is her being gorgeous and him being thrown off by it. The frustration that comes in the show is, yes, obviously Yuri is this dumb little kid that doesn't understand what love is, and he's doki-doking all the time, and he's constantly thinking that she's poisoned him or something like that and throwing suspicion at her. It doesn't really do anything outside of that. There was like a hint of something in the first episode that they're obviously going to eventually get into. My assumption was it's going to be something like Shonen Maid, where yes, it's about, you know, these goofy shenanigans about a butler or maid and the master of the house, but every now and then maybe sprinkling in, like, some wholesomeness, like, you know, belonging and stuff like that that might be in there. Obviously, Yuri has lost his family. Probably get into quite a bit of that. Why does Lilith know Yuri? Obviously, she knows him from the past. The moment that she got word that his parents died, she rushed to his place. So she knows him. They insinuate something in the OP, which obviously indicates that they know each other. So it's I think there'll be some interesting moments in getting into know why Lilith knows Yuri. And yes, having those wholesome moments where we do have this little bit of just belonging that they're going to kind of get into. But, and they're apparently going to have another butler and a maid eventually that'll probably add some chemistry. But so far, it's very samey. Like, I get a kick out of it. Again, it's kind of similar to something like Teasing a Master Takagi-san, where it's like, if those punchlines hit you, you're probably going to enjoy watching the show, even though it kind of is, in a sense, repetitive. But it's just, again, Tanmei that's absolutely gorgeous. So,
have you noticed that this show seems to have a crisis of era that it's in? It feels like it's in, like, the 20s, and then it randomly in the last episode it pulls up a switch for whatever reason. It's like, yeah. what era are you in?
Turn the century and suddenly switch. Yeah, I think the switch is probably the only thing that's kind of thrown there oddly. I don't know why it's there, but
they did.
Sure.
They did something else in the last episode. I was like, that didn't seem right. Why? What era are you in? And but yeah, it's
a pseudo era.
Yeah,
where it's got like parts of everything.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, Victorian, all that kind of stuff. Anyways, yeah, the maid I hired recently is mysterious. Again, if you like Tan Maid, check it out. If not, I guess you can wait till we get to a point where it's going to get into something possibly impactful. But that's the shtick. You're either going to like it or you're not going to like it. So I'm not going to try to sell anybody on it, honestly, is what I'm saying. Besides, unless you like Tan Maid. And there's a lot of really gorgeous art out there of Lilith, so enjoy that, too. The maid I hired recently is mysterious. Parallel World Pharmacy, or Isekai Yakkyoku. This one's streaming on Crunchyroll. Don't know how long it's running for. It's being done by Studio Diomedia. The source is a light novel. The genres are fantasy. And the director on this one is Keizo Kusakawa, who did Happy Sugar Life, Ken Cully, and Rokubyo. The series composition by Wataru Watari, who did Snafu, Girlish Numbers. It created Snafu and Girlish Number, as well as did series composition for Saints Magic Powers Omnipotent. So, there you go. And this one follows a guy that's in our current times, Japan. He is a researcher for medicine. We come to find out that his sister a long time ago had a... It was like a... I think they were insinuating it was a tumor or something like that. Some sort of terminal illness. And unfortunately, they had no cure for it. So she ended up passing away. And so that became his driving force for his life, is that he doesn't want anybody else to experience that. That inability to have some sort of cure for some sort of illness and face the same thing he did. So he's just studying day and night, researching, doing all this stuff to the point that he overworks himself and dies. Well, cut forward, and now he wakes up in the body of a young boy named Pharma de Medicis. Yes, Pharma. Pharma de Medicis. he's a part of this noble family that is known for being very well, you know, suited for doing medicine. Their whole field of being nobles is in pharmacy. And the thing they kind of cue in very quickly is that there's a high expectations placed upon him as a child of this family that he needs to excel at this. He needs to have massive knowledge in it. And yes, he needs to know how to do, what was it called, divine arts, which is like their magic in this world. And if he can't, then he's probably going to get kicked out of the family. But yeah, that's the problem that he's facing, is now he's in the body of this child who apparently the day before got hit by lightning. And now he's in this body and he doesn't know anything about the family and everything. Thankfully, his maid, Lot, is kind of helping him by refreshing his memory. She's like, oh, well, you must have lost your memory because you got hit by lightning. Well, he's, again, an isekai. So the assumption is that he came in the lightning bolt or something. But so yeah, he has to figure out what's going on in this world, everything about divine arts, medicine in this world. So it's kind of this interesting thing where, yes, he can apply his knowledge in pharmacy in his new life because now he's in the body of this child that's a part of this family of medicine. But at the same time, things are a little bit different. Like, he, at some point, she takes him to his study and has all these books, but it's all like old, outdated medicines and stuff like that. So obviously he has a little bit of a one-up from his of this world, because his previous world he had more knowledge and the medicine was more advanced. But it is, there's also an element that as he goes through his first real trial, which is the queen having an illness and his father diagnosing it without using the methods that he does, he obviously understands that even though he does have more knowledge from his previous life, there's still things that he can learn from his father of this world, because without the tools that he had, his father figured it out, which was kind of interesting. But yeah, so it's just, and also terrifying his his teacher Ellen, who teaches him in magic and stuff like that, obviously very quickly realizes that he's got like an insane aptitude to divine magics, and that kind of terrifies her. She uses this little meter wand thing that can test how much mana capability you have, and he basically broke it, so that terrified her. And then she discovered that, oh yeah, you don't have a shadow, that's not right. He's got this mark of the pharmacy god or whatever on his arm, and also the fact that he has this kind of goddess eye or something like that only divine have, which is the ability to see where people are inflicted with some sort of illness or pain. All these things kind of add up that Varma is like some sort of reincarnation of this god of medicine, and that terrifies Ellen, and so she doesn't want to have anything to do with him, but then eventually accepts to help him out, so to keep him from destroying the world, essentially. But yeah, your thoughts on Parallel World Pharmacy? I was all over the place on that one. I apologize.
It's I really like this. It has given us in the first few episodes a absolutely solid setup. At the point that we're going into now, he's basically set himself up as a shop owner, and it'll be interesting to see where they go from here, because they did really solidly in the.
Did he get a shop already?
Yeah.
Oh, I missed that part. I just seen where he got the medicine for the queen. So.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
All right. No, we're doing first impressions. It's my fault.
It's interesting that we've gotten to the point of getting this set up, and where they go from here. If they go along the same kind of similar setup as they've done so far, where they meet the patient, he learns a little bit, at the same time he uses his knowledge to kind of push the medicine in this world forward a little bit, I think that we could have a really solid, fun and interesting world that they already have, because of the fact that this is like we've had similar shows before where
many isekai farm shows. There's exactly. So many of them,
and
surprisingly a large amount of them.
Interestingly enough, they've never really kind of gotten to the meat of it like this one has. Where you're,
and I think
using...
that's probably because a lot of people have mentioned the idea that the creator was like, has knowledge in medicine, like they were in medicine, so it makes sense that he actually has, when you do see him doing a lot of this stuff with the medicine itself and a lot of the chemical creation, it's actually real medicine. So that was a really cool thing to add to it,
right? And that's
as people mentioned, it's Dr. Stone medicine, or Dr. Stone medicine version of it or something.
it is it's one of those things where the best people to do a story about something like that is somebody who has an intimate knowledge of this stuff, and that's absolutely it shows in a lot of the things that he's doing, and I really, really do give it credit for that, and I that's one of the things that gives me high hopes for where they can go from this point. And so yeah, I'm highly excited about
it. Isn't it sad to think that somebody that okay, so guy goes into medicine, learns about medicine, and then at some point decides to quit medicine, make a manga as a light novel about a guy who loses patience and wants to learn more medicine to create cures, and instead of actually going and help people. But I mean, it could be inspiring people to become in the medical practice. That there you go. He quits medicine to make a manga that or a light novel to inspire people to become, you know, doctors.
I agree.
Sacrifice yourself to create more.
Yep.
Right. I think the first episode was okay. Honestly, there was a funny thing at some point when you get that realization. I really like the ending, honestly. It was the first case that I've ever seen. They didn't stick with it, but they did create this idea of like, wow, it's kind of refreshing to have an actual real response to this kid's overpowered. you're going to be terrified. Like he blasts this huge jet of water. He breaks this meter thing. She's literally like, she's still accepting kind of that at that point. She's like, you know, it's okay. Just don't show your father. Don't even show your father that you have this mana capability. We'll figure something out. It wasn't until he started mentioning the idea that he could do this thing with the eye, which only Divine have. And then on top of that, him not having a shadow. That's what set her off. And she literally bolted into the forest, like, terrified. And I'm like, cool, that's refreshing to once not have a Segoy moment for the OP main character, for everybody around him. It was a genuine fear. And I'm like, that was great. They did a pretty good job of kind of pulling her back into the mix, because it wasn't a simple case of him going, no, you're overthinking it. It wasn't a case of, okay, well, I'll fix your problems and you'll like me now. It really went for the route of, she still thinks that he's a reincarnation of this divine being, but she's kind of like, okay, well, then I'm just going to have to guide him instead, which I did appreciate how that kind of went that direction. But it was funny kind of going back and realizing, yeah, they did a good job of, technically, the end of the first episode, you finally realize, oh, he doesn't have a shadow this entire time. And you can go back and you can watch the entire episode. And yes, sure enough, they're doing a pretty good job of making sure that he never has a shadow. But he's still casting a shadow. Like even this picture that we have on our thing here, he's casting a shadow under his armpit. He's casting a shadow on his neck. He's always casting a shadow. It's just there's no shadow under his feet. But I seen one shot where he was sitting on the bed and you can actually see the shadow on the bed. So it's like, okay, well, they're still doing shading and stuff, which I understand, because they would look very awkward if he didn't have any sort of shading. But anyways, that was kind of a funny thought process. But no, following the first episode, which I think was a good setup, second episode was a lot of him kind of figuring out things around him and trying to figure out how the eye works, and then helping the maids and butlers, which he's technically not supposed to be doing. They're not supposed to provide aid and stuff to them because they're commoners. And then I think when it really started getting into the queen, that's where I really... Well, I think the sister was good too, because I think it was... It didn't hit on as hard as I thought it would, but he's technically saving the sister that he never saved. So now that he has a second shot, his sister has, was it smallpox or something like that? He's able to help her. Was it chickenpox? Some sort of pox. He's able to finally save his sister when he wasn't able to in his previous life. So I thought that they were going to hit on that a little bit harder, but it was still a good scene. But this is where we're starting to get this point where everybody's starting to realize that he's kind of different. And even the father does at some point realize, you know, you're kind of different. You're not the son that I remember. The whole thing with the queen, I think, was a great solidification of what they can do with the story. Because I like that he doesn't just come in there and say, I'm overpowered, here's a cure. It's really, it's very grounded in the reality of what medicine is. Medicine isn't a boom, you're healed. This isn't a case where he goes around and touches his hands on everybody and says, heal, and everybody gets healed. He is doing actual medicine. These things, a lot of them, especially like in the case of, what was it, the White Death, he's technically has to create a regimen. Like, you have to take this on this regular basis to get rid of this. This isn't an overnight thing. And what was great was that how he presented that was perfect. It was kind of funny, because when he first comes in, he's like, hold on a second. Here. Look at this, queen. I'm like, what is he doing? It was him showing them why he's doing what he's doing. He was playing the role of an actual doctor. It wasn't him going, here, queen, take this at once every couple days and you'll be good. And everybody's going to accept it. No, he has to explain to them why he came to the conclusion that he did, so that they trust him in how he's going to fix the problem. And I liked how it laid that out. It made sense to me, and thus it would probably make sense to the group that's in there, which everybody is obviously going to look to him as a child. Why is this child even confronting the queen? You had this whole room of everybody that was... And I liked how why she accepted him. Why she chose to accept his help. Because he came forward and said, queen, can you let me, you know, can you let me take care of you? And the reason why she accepted it, because she knew everybody around her was accepting her fate. He was the only one that wasn't. And she could see it. She did study medicine, so she understood. So it was really cool to have essentially the queen be the one that is able to usher him into being accepted by the field of medical, because otherwise I don't think anybody would ever accept what he said. And again, that does technically play into his father not understanding why he's doing what he's doing, and obviously not thinking that he's his son anymore, but it was really cool. I think that episode overall really did sell me on this show, because again, it showed that it wasn't simple cast heal and everything saved. It showed, and now technically he's still overpowered in the idea that he can create anything. I thought I got a kick out of it because he made like some cream for Lut, and he's going through this whole process. Create this, mix this, create this, mix it. I'm like, if you can... If you can literally create anything, why not just create the final product? You know what the chemical mixture is. And sure enough, he does that with the medicine for the queen. So I'm like, why didn't he do that with the hand cream before? He knows what the chemical layout is. But anyways, it's cool. Like I said, it is technically grounded in reality of medicine. I like that. There's not an easy way out of things. The drama they've set up so far is really great. The essentially the structures of, you know, the nobles and the rulership and the medical field, all that stuff was really well placed out there. And so it does have me excited for what's going forward. This is definitely not your typical isekai pharmacy show. This is definitely more grounded in reality, and hopefully it doesn't get dumb from this point on, but from those first 3 or 4 episodes, I was pretty sold on it. Again, it had a little bit of a rocky start, but, and it had like the most Mushoku Tensei Jobless Reincarnation first spell cast ever moment, but other than that, everything else was kind of really well played out, so I'm looking forward to it. And I think he's got a really solid grounding from his previous life, so unlike most where it's a Y isekai, this one technically does have a lot of his previous life is his driving force, and he doesn't want to have, he still has those elements of not wanting others to die. That's really been his entire driving force. Is his previous driving force for his previous life is his driving force now. I'm assuming that a lot of his driving force is probably going to be around the commoners, that they don't have good methods of getting medicine because it's so expensive. And I'm sure that's probably going to cause a big problem because he's technically serving the commoners, probably really cheap or if anything free. But I think that'll be really cool. I do like that aspect though. So
it is one of those things that I absolutely love the fact that they're setting it up for that. Like Andrew was saying, setting it up for the commoners, and it's one of those things that he's already got somebody who's got their eye on him, and I love how they set that up. One of the other kind of cool tidbits that they did in with the queen and all that stuff is the aspect of because technically in a way this is you're talking, we know that we're talking chemical compositions and all that stuff, but to them it's in a way it's a different type of magic. You're using almost an alchemy and stuff like that. One of the interesting things that kind of portrayed this well to me anyway was the fact that when he had a medicine for the queen, he was taking it at the same time as her. Of if this is poison, I will be going down the same fate as you. So it was well done in that respect. Of every day he would go to give her this medicine, and he was literally taking this medicine as well to prove that it was safe. So I really like that. There's so many little tidbits in each one of these scenes that that I think is really well done, and I love it for that.
They obviously never watched Justified. It was already in the jar. I'm joking. That's a reference only me and people that watch the show get. Anyways, yeah, that's a recommendation for me. I'm enjoying it. It's definitely not your typical pharma isekai, which I think most of the isekai pharma shows aren't bad. It's just they don't really have a lot of this gives me more feels of something like Mushoku Tensei. Like this is pushing more towards Mushoku Tensei than, you know, power fantasy that most isekai pharmacy shows have. So yeah, more grounded. So yeah, and I really like the scene with the father, though. That was really good. I really did like that. Like I said, the idea of him not, like, his father's like, you know more than me. You've advanced way further than I have. And he's like, no, you showed me that I can still learn something. You figured it out without doing all the stuff that I did. So it's obvious this guy knows what he's doing. So Parallel World Pharmacy. Check that out if that's interesting to you. The Yakuza's Guide to Babysitting, or Kumicho Musume to Sebagakari. This one's streaming on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes. The studio is Feel and Gaina. The source is a manga. The genres are comedy, slice of life. The director is Itsuro Kawasaki, who did Listen to Me, Girls, I'm Your Father, Be the Beginning, and Magical Girl Ore. Series composition by Kiichiro Ochi, who did Quintessential Quintuplets, Hinamatsuri, and Demon Girl Next Door. And this one follows the Yakuza family of Kazuhiko Sakuragi. And under Sakuragi is one person known as Toru Kirishima. And Kirishima is super violent. He's very well known for every time he's sent out for a job, it usually ends in him beating the crap out of everybody to a bloody pulp, even though he's supposed to not And everybody tells him, you're going to get in trouble with Sakuragi if you get another fight, and he still does it. But yeah, so one day, Sakuragi gives Kirishima a new mission. He says, you know, you need to learn, you know, to not resort to violence all the time. You need to learn responsibility and more of a more gentle touch, I guess. And that new job is to take care of his daughter, Yaika Sakuragi, which has recently moved in to live with him because her mother is unfortunately in a coma, and her mother's sister, I think it was a sister, is not going to take care of her forever. So, but yeah, Kirishima's new job is to take care of Yaika and take her to school and protect her and all this kind of stuff, because obviously the daughter of a Yakuza boss is probably in danger all the time. So yeah, that's kind of the deal so far, is just him taking care of her. At some point you have her having this kind of open house at her school, and so he decides to go, you know, be there for her. Some point you have, you know, her going to see her mother. She doesn't really want to go see her mother anymore because she has some issues with that, and eventually Kirishima talks her into it and she accepts it and goes there and has a nice little moment with her. So, and then they got at the hospital, they got a little bit into a past guy that was a part of the Yakuza family too. So kind of just a story beat by story beat moment with the series so far. So your thoughts?
I really like this show in general because cutesy girl and gruff guy just kind of works really well. I just love the way that they've kind of made this whole wholesome thing and still sprinkle in these comedy beats, like the last one, for whatever reason, the boss decided to make them into streamers. And it's one of those things that I really do love that about this show. However, what I was not expecting was one of the episodes in particular, in Kirishima talking Yaika to go and see her mom. And she absolutely refused to, for reasons that are shown in the show. And I don't want to kill the moment too much. But what I was really blown away with was how much this scene really just hit. And I thought it was a fantastic scene. It really, really did pull some tears out of me. It was a fantastic scene. And that's one of the things that I do really kind of give the show credit for, is they have these moments here and there that are just like real heart tug pull moments that I just really like. Other than that, it's just, I wish it was a little bit more, because it seemed like Kirishima really chilled out very fast.
Yes.
That's the only kind of thing that I do kind of wish was a little bit more, kind of just more along the lines of him being really gruff at first, and then her just slowly softening his heart instead of just, okay, I'll just be a really good boy from now on. So that's the only thing that I kind of bug about this show. Other than that, the rest of it is fantastic. I love it.
Yeah, the whole violent side of Kirishima is really just a punchline, and that was, I honestly felt the same way when I first watched the first episode, because I went from like, I kept shifting what I thought the show was going to be when we were looking at the previews, because it felt like, okay, this is going to be gruff guy that gets his heart softened by cute girl. And then it immediately went into, okay, I watched the PV and I'm like, no, this is full-on comedy, basically bunny drop. Like, this is guy taking care of this cute girl and making sure she's happy, super wholesome. And then I watched the first part of the first episode, I'm like, no, maybe not. We're probably going to have him be super violent and constantly going back and forth between the two of them. And then, no, it's like, yeah, literally, the moment he's assigned to take care of Yaika, it's like, suddenly, he's just a big teddy bear now. And there's no teeth anymore. What I kind of liked was that, and I was hoping they would kind of keep balancing that, is having these moments where, yeah, Yaika's in danger, and then suddenly he goes out of his way to make a game out of it in order to hide her from the violence that he's going to do, which is take out these guys that he met earlier, which I found a lot of fun in that kind of stuff. But that's kind of the mixture so far, is just him kind of, the shenanigans with him and the other Yakuza, and maybe possibly people showing up that want to, you know, so far for me, it's been him just them trying to take down Kirishima. And then having these really heartfelt moments where he essentially just gives encouragement to Yaika. That's really been a majority of the show, is just these wholesome moments with this big roughy guy that's, again, not really violent, taking care of Yaika and helping her push past these boundaries that she's kind of set for herself. yes, the boundary of, you know, I don't think my father will like this picture that I drew at the open house. And he gives that push. Well, I don't want to see mother because this and that. Gives her that push. Now, granted, the push that he gave her was, like, super mean. Like, I'm like, why would you tell a kid that? Like, why would you? And again, I guess I can kind of equate it to the idea that, you know, this is technically a Yakuza family, so I can see them not being really, like, super religious or whatever. But it was kind of a mean thing to tell a young child. But whatever, it got her in the room, so why not? But yeah, kind of just showing how it's one of those things where, I guess, from the outset, it kind of seems like, okay, Yakuza family. Obviously, they deal with a lot of terrible things. But for the most part, it's one of those things where once you have that preconceived notion, but once you get past the door, it's just a big wholesome family. Yes, there's rules they set for themselves, but they're all just a big happy family. And I think that was kind of solidified for me when they did get into, I think it was Aoi, was the guy that left to take care of his family. And it's like, yeah, they technically do care for each other, and he did let him go because he understands the importance of family. Family is always the first thing. So it's a big wholesome show with a bunch of really cute moments with big gruffy guy taking care of young girl. So they keep hinting at this guy that loves cologne. So I'm assuming eventually it's going to get, it's probably not going to get dark. They're trying to make it out like it's going to get dark soon, but we'll see. We'll see if it ever does that. It just, so far, it seems like every episode we have a small, brief 10-second clip of this guy being obsessed with Kirishima. So hopefully that'll turn to something decent, but we'll see. Bam. The Yakuza's Guide to Babysitting. If you're looking for some wholesome for the season, I don't think there's anything else that's going to be in this one's par, so check that out if you're looking for that. The League of Nations Air Force Aviation Magic Band Luminous Witches is our next one. That's a long title. I just call it Luminous Witches. Reime Kugon Kyoku Maho Ongakutai Luminous Witches. This one's streaming on High Dive, running for 12 episodes, done by Studio Shaft. The source is an original. Not really. It's based off of the brand of Strike Witches. I think it's a multimedia project mobile game, if I remember correctly. But yeah, it's not really Strike Witches, though. We'll get into that. I don't know why they have genres as ecchi, but I do agree with the music part. This is not an ecchi show. Please do not take that as being an ecchi show. So far, anyways. Director is Shoji Saiki, who did Assault Lilies, Playtest, and Medoka Box. Sorry. Yeah, this one follows a group of girls. Well, it essentially opens up with this girl named Gracie, who is a part of, like, a commander or something within the Strike Witches forces. And at some point, she's essentially noting a problem. For those that don't know about Strike Witches, there's a problem in this world that essentially each girl in this world can possibly become one of these witches. And they have some sort of ability. And they go into the Air Force to don on these kind of propeller feet where they fly around the sky and they fight back against this alien force. And there's a problem with this, in the idea that when you reach a certain age, I think it was like when you hit 20, which is basically your oldest fart in the world of anime. when you reach the age of the great old age of the 20s or whatever, you lose your magic ability, and thus you're useless to the army. And then, of course, there's also the aspect that not all the girls in that are going to be witches are great at shooting. They're not, you know, good at combat, whatever. So there's kind of there's an issue within this world's army, in that if you're not useful, you're useless. And so she wants to sort of create a place for them. And so she wants to take all these girls that have lost their magic ability or they're just not good at fighting and give them a platoon to work with, which is this musical group, basically. This musical group will serve two purposes. It gives them a place to be and still be a part of the fight, but at the same time, they will be able to create encouragement for those that are fighting on the front lines, as well as those that are ravaged by the battles that happen. So it's kind of a cool concept that she's kind of created she's seen an issue and she's trying to resolve it. And so she's creating this group of singers. Well, insert huge cast of girls that all have their own issues. You have, like, one girl is terrible at aiming. You have one girl that just is obsessed with this one singer and is also terrible. Each one of them have their own issues. One was, like, she's really good every now and then. Yeah. This one girl is, like, she's super lazy and everything, but every now and then she goes out there and she's super good. It's just a big cast of girls that all answer the call to this place to exist, basically. One in particular special girl was Guinea, and she's like a night witch, like this, and she has like this ability to create like this radio system where she's able to hear people from a distance and stuff. So she's always been singing. But yeah, that's Luminous Witches so far. Your thoughts?
Yeah, as Andrew was saying, the most interesting aspect of this show is kind of the flip of this is the idea of this main girl kind of trying to build a basically an idol group, for lack of a better term, out of the rejects. And that's the aspect that I do kind of really like about this, is the aspect of building this idol group, going around from place to place and re-sparking hope. And I do really like that, especially with the ones that, like I said, are effectively the rejects. This actually kind of brings out what is kind of special about this show in the aspect of kind of an aspect that's not really kind of talked about in the mainline show. Yeah, the girls are all happy and
did you finally get caught up on the show?
No, the mainline series I have not watched. I've watched a lot of the other ones.
Oh, okay. You said something wasn't in it. I was like, wait, you watched it?
Well, yeah, that's the thing, is I can infer, unless you know something I don't, that they talk about keeping up morale in those ones as well. I don't remember ever seeing it in the ones that I have watched, which are the side stories. That was kind of the joke, is that I've watched a lot of the side shows, but not the main show.
Not focused on increasing morale, but yeah, the destruction and trying to, you know, spark some sort of fight. So
yeah, the girls themselves, they're all happy in their barracks, that's for sure. At any rate, this entire unit is solely focused on keeping up morale and keeping up hope, especially at least so far the civilian side, for sure. I'm assuming at some point they'll get into raising morale and on the battle lines or whatever have you, but for right now it's been on the civilian side. And that's one thing that I do think is very interesting about this and could be really neat, especially if they are ever in a situation where they are trying to raise the morale of the front line. That would be a really neat tidbit for them to do. So I love it so far. But outside of that, that's all they're really doing.
Yeah, I think my biggest frustration I have with this show is that it's not Strike Witches. Like, it's Strike Witches, but it's not Strike Witches. It has none of the... It has the brand under it, that they're technically in the same world, but everything else, the feel of the show is not Strike Witches. It's not cute girls hanging out, having fun, tons of ecchi, go out in the battlefield, shoot stuff, and come back. It's literally... like I said earlier to joke, but it's really honestly my opinion, is like, it feels like just a branding, like, just let's use the Strike Witch's name, create a bunch of cute girls, make a mobile game and let them sing to rhythm or something like that. And that's the biggest problem that I have. It just feels like this is just a big cash grab, because again, it doesn't have anything that I, as a fan of Strike Witches, and yes, you could probably say I'm a terrible person because I think it's a lot to do with the fact that there's no ecchi or anything like that, but it just feels like all the chemistry. And again, everything that makes a Strike Witches show is not here. This is just to be perfectly honest, this is just strictly a idol show, cute girls doing cute things, with the Strike Witches brand being used to sell it. And that's the sucky thing, honestly. Outside of that, my complaints and that whole thing, I'm a little bit shocked that Shaft is doing the show in the end, because it's not as... It still looks good. Don't get me wrong. It's not a bad-looking show. The CGI is terrible,
yeah.
To be perfectly frank. They use the CGI. They didn't use it for a lot of the flying that they've shown in the show so far that I've watched, because they were technically wearing casual. But I'm assuming at some point they will have a uniform that will have a render to do CGI for flying too. But yeah, the whole opening sequence is all CGI, and it's just, ugh, Shaft, really? Like, we have over here Shinepost is kicking your butt. was it Studio Kai that was doing Shinepost, I think it was? It's kind of a huge letdown that Shaft, of anybody's having problems putting together a show. But no, outside of that, I mean, it had a couple wonky character design moments, especially like with the interview section and stuff like that, which I got a kick out of, honestly. They have this whole interview section where they're going through each of the girls to interview if they're going to be able to join this group. And each one of the girls literally have zero. And it's like, okay, so if your whole thing is like, I want to create a place for people, the people that can't fight on the battlefield, the people that are terrible at it, or they don't have the guts to do it, or they've lost their magic. Let's create a place for them. Interview. So why did you want to be a singer? No, you created a place for people that can't be successful at something. They're not coming to you because they want to sing. They're coming to you because they need a place. Did we not catch that?
Well,
None of them came there to sing.
One of them, their quirk is they want to be in the background. So they don't want to be in anything that is involved in the front. And so they interview them to see if you want to be an idol. I don't want to do anything that is in the front.
Inori, literally Inori comes there, comes all the way to this place, answered the call for this bulletin, comes in there, sits down to say, you should find Ginny. So why are you here? I just want to let you know that you should find Ginny because she's really good at singing. Who's Ginny? We should go find her.
It's this person that I met 5 minutes ago. Well, then what did you come here for in the first place?
Ginny wants to do this? Like, why is your assumption that Ginny wants to do this either? Yeah, one girl's like, I just want to sing because I heard that this singer's with you guys. Yeah, one of them just wants to have anything. Yeah, it was dorky that nobody really literally wanted to do anything that Gracie's doing. But again, you're creating a place for rejects. They're obviously not going to come there because they want to be there. But no. It's fine. So far, I think my biggest problem is that it's not doing anything so far with the cute girls doing cute things that I've enjoyed. The comedy's not really there for me so far. Again, I think it really feels like it was thrown together for the sake of selling these idol girls and their music CDs probably with the branding of Strike Witches with it. And to not even have, again, any, like, zero, like, unless something happens after they all get Ginny and they go back to the place together. Zero.
They just start idling.
Literally zero etchy. Unless you've seen something on that part. Zero. Zero. Like, again, this probably sounds really terrible and whatever, but I'm going to say it. I literally, after watching the first three or so episodes, I went on Twitter and said, I cannot believe I just watched this many episodes of a Strike Witches branded show and didn't even have a single panty shot. Like, it's, again, this zero ecchi, which, again, is very not Strike Witches. Strike Witches, you can't go in a scene without seeing something. It was full on ecchi. That show is crazy ecchi.
Well, so that's what 99% of the controversy over the show was, because they just never wore skirts. So,
yeah. And
I remember that whole thing was people either loved it or hated it because of the skirt thing.
Yeah, the canon of the world, and again, I've had some people disagree with me and a lot of people agree with me. I don't know why this is a controversy or a weird subject that we can't come to an agreement on. The canon of the world of Strike Witches is that any girl that is a witch and goes to fight, again, they have to plug these things on their legs, which are like basically propellers to fly them around. And the whole idea is that you can't wear pants because of those. So most of them wear skirts, or they wore just tights, or again, just wore a bikini bottom, or yeah, just nothing but pantsu. And that was the whole shtick with the world of Strike Witches. And the oddity that came from that is that girls, not even witches, would not wear pants or skirts because they looked up to them. It was a way of like saying, I want to be fighting on the battlefield. Like these girls that are out there fighting against this threat, this alien threat that's destroying the world, they look up to them, and so they don't wear skirts. It was the whole canon was that. It's dumb, but it's an excuse for ecchi, but it was the canon of that world. So anyways, I'm going to stop talking about things that just make me look bad because everybody's like, oh my gosh, this guy's a perv. Luminous Witches. If you just want an idol show, check it out. If you want Strike Witches, if you're like a super fan, you just want something, I guess it's there. We'll see. Let's go on one to another. Phantom of the Idol. Or Kamikuzu Idol. This one's streaming on High Dive, running for 10 episodes. I guess I'm already halfway through the show. I might as well finish it. I forgot this is 10 episodes. This one, like, started before anything else, and it's almost done already. So this is going to be an early ender. Studio is Gokumi. Source is a manga. The genres are comedy, supernatural. The director is Daiki Fukuoka, who did Danganronpa and Yukino as a Hero. And this one follows a guy named Yuya Niyodo. And Niyodo is a duo idol member with a guy named Yoshino. And the two of them sing on the stage together. And it's very obvious very quickly. Yoshino seems like he takes his job seriously. He does a good job. He's your typical pretty boy on the stage and everything. But Miniato is terrible. He is absolutely terrible. He just has a grumpy face all the time. He just gets up there and sings. You kind of find out that he was confronted by a producer that said, hey, look, you want a job where you don't really have to do much. You just got to go on the stage and everything and make a lot of money. And he's like, yeah, sure, because that's his thing. He just really badly wants to make easy money. And so he accepts and joins. Well, they after a performance, they go back to their manager, and their manager basically says, yeah, I'm going to disband the group because you're terrible. And the only thing that kind of saves the whole situation is that while Yuya's off the side kind of contemplating the fact that he's about to get fired and, again, realizes that he's terrible, but he just wants easy money, he's confronted by a girl named Asahi Mogami. And Asahi is actually a previous idol. Like, she's a very popular idol. But unfortunately, a year ago, I think it was about that same time, a year ago, she had passed away, unfortunately. So the whole shtick here is that her, Asahi, as this ghost, she's able to possess Yuya's body. And in possessing his body, she's able to go on stage for him and perform and do incredible. So that's kind of becomes a thing. It kind of goes back and forth between the idea that Yuya does just wants to have easy money, while Asahi wants to, is loves being an idol and wants to kind of instill upon him that love for being an idol, but it never works because Yuya just wants easy money. He doesn't want to get up and exercise. He doesn't want to practice, all this kind of stuff. So he kind of always expects Asahi to do it for him. So, and then at some point they get into Kazuko, his partner, and his insecurities around things. It gets a lot into the fans of Yuya and how they are kind of a little bit freaked out by the fact that this guy that they've always cheered on and he's always been mean and gruff suddenly out of nowhere gets on the stage and he's super bubbly, girly type, and it completely throws them off. And they're kind of shocked by the idea that, you know, they got this rare performance from him. Like, he's never done this before, and they got to see him suddenly be different. And yeah, suddenly everybody wants to buy his merch because he is suddenly good. So, your thoughts? Did you get a chance to watch it?
I didn't even bother.
Yeah. All I have on my pros is Nao Toyama, and all I have on my cons is CGI and visuals overall are terrible. There you go. That's the show. This show is like one of those prime examples of, you know, whenever people say, why you care about Japanese, you always complain about dubs and how they all sound the same, but I think all the Japanese sound the same. And our argument always is we have all these seiyus like Nao Toyama, Aoyuki, all these ones that we just love. The moment we hear them, we know it's them. There's an issue with getting to where we're at with Japanese seiyus in that we hear them and we love them, we immediately gravitate towards their characters, is that whenever you have a show where one of your favorite seiyus is literally talking all the time and you just don't care about the show. This is like a true test of Andrew's patience, is that I love Asahi because it's Nao Toyama and I love her voice, but at the same time, I could care less about the show. It looks like, but the CGI is horrific, like literally thing of nightmares. When they're on the stage and they're dancing, it's a thing of nightmares, which is weird because Studio Gakumi does good work. Like, Yuki Yuna as a Hero is a great visually looking show. Very artistically beautiful. And the CGI, when they used it in Yuki Yuna as a Hero, it's always far away, and so you couldn't really see it. But here, it's every stage performance is this terrible looking CGI. Outside of that, I'm just not really caring much about the chemistry. Like, I get the concept of the bubbly idol and her trying to... It's not like she's trying to instill upon him that he should love being an idol. She's just expressing how much she loves it, and it's not rubbing off on Yuya, I guess, like she would think that it would. So all these things that she's trying to push him to getting better, he accepts, but at the same time, it's always to a goal of, I just want to make money. And he's a dirtbag, and they're happy about saying that he's a dirtbag every single episode. Like, the moment that she finally gets him on the stage and he performs and she enjoyed it so much, and then she goes to pass away. Like, she finally has seen the light and she's going to pass away finally. And he's literally going, no, you can't go anywhere yet because we have to go to the big stage. And he suddenly just stops fading away. And it's this whole thing of, like, he just literally kept her from passing on because you want to use her to make money because you're so lazy. And you just want her to take over your body so that you can just relax and do nothing. yeah, it's very shrug. It's a very shrug show, but like I said, I'm probably going to keep watching it because I'm almost, like, I think I'm halfway through at this point, and now Toyama, she's great, but I don't know. It's just not working for me. This is technically a comedy show, so some people might find some of the bits a lot more funnier than I'm saying, so don't get me wrong. Just for me personally, it's not working. I have a thing against female idol fans, too. Every time I hear these girls screaming or whatever, it's like, grating upon me. And having these long segments where the girls are just sitting at a restaurant after the performance where they're just sitting there talking about how great he was or whatever, it gets really old. It's like the writing around the fans are just not there. Like, it's all about them being freaked about what just happened. And I don't need them to retell me what happened, you know, one scene before. It just feels like they're repeating the scene over and over again. So, yeah, I wish they would do something with them. Some comedy bit with them, but they're not really so far. So, Phantom of the Idol. Check that out if you're a fan of Natoyama. Check it out, I guess. Classroom of the Elite, second season. Oryokuso Jitsuroku Shijo Shugi no Kyoshitsu e second season. I think it's just second season for Japanese, but anyways, this is on Crunchyroll. I think it's running for 12 episodes. I could be wrong. Studio is Lurch. The source is light novel. The genres are comedy, romance, school drama. And yeah, this one takes place in the Kudo Ikusei Senior High School, which I think what we pretty much established. You do the synopsis since you've just rewatched the entire first season. You'll probably do a better job than me. Essentially a school where they don't find out until they get there, but it's like this really prestigious school. But everybody's assigned a class A through D. And depending on which class you're in, you get like a certain allowance each month, I think it was.
Yes.
And so the idea is that you want to get higher in the class ranks. You want to succeed in changing ranks. And each of these classes are essentially competing against each other in different tests. Technically, what you do outside of class can affect you as well. Like, they have this one guy damaged something at some store and the cameras caught it, so they docked him for it. So they have to act like perfect. So it's like a class has to work together for a goal. And obviously everybody in the D class are a bunch of idiots that don't want to work together initially. And then at some point in the first season, they went out to some like year one competition on a remote island. And now they're just heading back in second season. So did I catch everything?
Yeah, they've already gotten back. That's about the only thing that's different. So I'm assuming you missed one episode.
One episode, yeah.
just so everybody knows, yes, like Andrew said, I went and...
Yeah, because they were setting up for the school festival, or the sports festival.
Right. So, like Andrew said, yes, I technically just speed watched through... Well, I didn't really speed watch. I took my time with it and watched a couple of episodes
per day. Two times speed.
No, I did not do that. So in a way you're getting my first season review at the same time. I really do. I don't know why it didn't quite work, for me the first time I watched the show. Now that I've, actually finished everything, I do find this show, strangely interesting. There's a lot of really cool things and quirks in the show that I do find very fascinating. I like the something that we had mentioned before with this whole meritorious system, the point system that they have in this show. I think it's a really cool system that they had set up. Basing the students getting points based on their merits. So if they do something good, technically, they get more points. And these points are slowly building up for the class. And then at the end of a quarter / exam, whatever the heck it is that they decide on for this particular section, that will decide whether or not they get more points for the next few months. The one thing that is really irking me, and I told Andrew this, and I know that I'm blowing it way out of proportion, is they are not the character's year is becoming more and more irksome for me. There is more than one year in the show. and it is not their A, B, C, or D. That is not what makes somebody a second level or second year or whatever have you. So that's the one thing that's irking me. But outside of that, I do like the system. I think it's really cool and it's very interesting. There's, like Andrew was saying, they're setting up for the school festival. That should be an interesting tidbit. They're already arguing and deciding how they want to handle it. I do think that and I'm sure that Andrew's probably going to jump in at some point and point this out, is I do think that I wish it was a little bit more clear, but it's one of those, the curse of the smart character to talk about it. You don't see their breakdown of how they decide that something is how they're working it out, and eventually it all goes all according to, as Andrew loves to point out, Kikaku. Is at some point somebody's going to go, yeah, I figured it all out like way back here, and you're like, sure, the way you figured that out makes total sense, I guess. I mean, they're talking about this, the sun was, or the planets that they were using for this find the VIP game that they were doing this the last couple of episodes, was suddenly, because if you had actually paid attention, the planets actually revealed which character it actually was. And it was like, I guess, I mean, sure, you gave me all kinds of clues for that one. That makes perfect sense. So I guess you got to be smarter than me to figure all that stuff out super fast like these characters. So,
well, unless you knew what the layout of all the characters in the classrooms, you're not going to be able to figure it out. I mean, that's the whole idea. If you lay that out like that, it's not as if you could have figured it out, because, you don't know who's in each of the groups like fully. You don't have the full register. I mean, they showed a little bit, but it was namely them mentioning this is a group. This particular planet had this amount of each of the classrooms in it, but not necessarily who was in it. I was okay with the first season. I really didn't like their habit of, oh, here's cute girl, suddenly, oh no, she's actually a psychopath. I never cared for that arc. They kind of ruined a character for me in the first season, and I'm certain they'll probably do it again with the second season with this now Toyama girl being too bubbly. You're not allowed to be bubbly in these type of settings. They always have to be a sociopath underneath. I was okay with the first season. It wasn't great. And then, so getting caught up with the second season was a little bit of hesitation for me, because I just kind of assumed I wasn't going to enjoy it. And I'm kind of on the same boat. It's just kind of it's a very shrug series for me. It's always been a shrug series for me. And I think that's really because you have a lot of explanation about what they're doing, because essentially you have all these exams. So there's a test. So as they're coming home from this test that was on this remote island, they're given another test. They're all put in groups, assigned a planet, and the groups have to figure out who the quote-unquote VIP or the mole is in their group, and if they can guess it right, they can get a certain amount of points if they guess it right. And so you have like this long spiel of the whole system and how it's laid out and what the rules are and what's the results and all this build-up, and then literally an entire episode of nothing but we went into the meeting room, we sat around, nothing was solved.
Nothing was solved.
We went into the meeting room, because we talked a bunch, nothing was solved. We went into the meeting, and it keeps doing over and over again until eventually have a plan, and then, nope, this person won. Wait, what was all this build-up, and we spent all this time for nothing? Like, it felt so anticlimactic, and I guess that's the point, because it didn't go their way, but it's like super anticlimactic, and it just felt like I spent all this time building up for something that had no payoff in the end, which was, again, to the credit of the writer, that they're willing to say, you know, things didn't go according to Kikaku. It went according to somebody's Kikaku, but it was just kind of a lot of rules and systems, and we spent so much time just reestablishing something that just had no end into it. So that was quite a bit frustrating for me, honestly.
What was even greater about that the planet thing was that the way that the one class ruined the VIP system for the others is by just not talking to anybody. And so, yeah, like Andrew was talking about it, they just would go in there and they'd just sit there for a few minutes and nobody would talk. And then some people were talking to each other, but it was just normal classroom banter. Nobody's talking about the freaking VIP. They had all given up at that point. Yeah, they had all given up at that point.
And I guess technically the whole establishment here, honestly, I understand what the significance of that section is. It was really around Horikita really doing her own thing. Because something they kind of laid out with the end of the first season was this idea of Kyoji really kind of is it his name Ayano Koji?
I hate his name.
I know Koji is like,
just think of the cute
mastermind.
Think of the cute girl going Ayano Koji-kun.
Yeah, Ayano Koji is like the mastermind, and so he's like this, I don't know, lab experiment super genius dude that has zero emotions. He literally won the last game, but he gave all the credit to Horikita, and so most of this whole thing was essentially her having to work on her own, despite the fact that they're still working together with each other, and her competition against somebody else. And that was fine. I understand it. And technically a lot of this was set up with Kato Izawa, her essentially being pulled under Ayano Koji's, I guess, fold of cards that he has available to him, which I honestly thought was absolutely dog crap because of what he puts her through just to basically break her and force her to work under him. But I'm one to be okay with that kind of stuff to an extent because I understand that not everything has to be rosy. Like, nothing has to be done positively. Not every character has to be a stand-up person. He's a kind of a dirtbag, and they're kind of willing to do that. Technically, with the same case with the last show that we talked about, honestly, it's a show that has a main character that's a dirtbag. Sometimes it's for a reason, and I did kind of, I'm okay with that if it helps establish the characters. So we'll see if what goes on forward. It really feels like this next arc with the sports festival is, again, Ayano Koji really trying to push Horikita to essentially do right on her own, but with his little nudges that he can give her. But it always feels like he kind of stands off the side and does things and doesn't want to get involved with things. And then eventually at the very end, he gets involved and it all goes according to Keikaku, which we'll see if it has a payoff. Again, they didn't really pull that off with the last season, in my opinion. This first exam was really anticlimactic. So hopefully the next one's got some sort of cool ending to it that I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. That's cool. But so far, it's just, It's one of those kind of stories where I kind of wish that I can enjoy it because it seems really cool and really smart, but I'm always kind of let down in the end.
It's one of those things that I wonder if it's just because it's not translating well to the anime. I mean, and maybe somebody who's read the light novel can help me out a little bit on is it as because I love logic problems. Okay. That's my thing. I love logic problems. I love the stupid number, Sudoku, whatever. I love that kind of stuff. I love the puzzle aspect of a lot of those kinds of things. And this one seems like it should be, there should be enough clues that you should be able to pick up on a lot of this stuff. And then just going, there's a puzzle over there that you can't see. Here, let me give you a couple of clues, but not enough clues that, I mean, like I said, maybe I'm just stupid. And
that's the thing. The light novel, they could probably lay out every character in each of the room or each of the planets, and then right. You could have figured it out. But And I think it would have been probably something you could probably figure out the moment that they do sort of nudge as to who could be in their group that was the one. So.
That was my biggest problem with like Danganronpa. Yeah, I love the idea of solving the mystery, but if you don't give me, you just blah, this is the person, and oh yeah, the clues were there the entire time. No, it doesn't work like that. So yeah, it that's just a frustration. Other than that, I love the concept and the world that they're building here. So yeah.
Please, writer, don't ruin Ichinose. You already ruined Kushida. Please don't ruin Ichinose. That's all I'm asking the writer. Just don't ruin another character. Shadow House, second season. This one's streaming on Crunchyroll, being done by Studio Cloverworks. The source is a manga. The genres are slice of life, supernatural, and seinen. For those that are completely unfamiliar with Shadow House, it essentially opens up. The first season is about a house full of these shadows. They're basically people that look like they're just silhouettes. Their entire body is covered with, like, soot. They're just black. And they all incorporate these things known as living dolls that stand beside them. So, essentially, when a Shadow House family member is in this particular Shadow House, they are assigned a living doll. At a young age, they have to essentially work together with that doll to sort of make them their face. So whenever they are expressive, because you can't see them because, they're pretty much a silhouette. Every time they're expressive, their living doll needs to be there at their side at all times to give their expression. So if they ever meet with people, they're able to see what expression they have. And pretty much the entirety of the first season was them going to a debut where these young children, after they're assigned a living doll and they practice with them, they have to go to this debut to prove that they can be a member of the Shadow House family. And then going into the second season, a lot of the focus is around this cloak figure that's in this children's wing of the Shadow House, and these breakouts of all these soot monster thingies. They're called scorches, which is like the soot itself, if it's left be and it's not cleansed over time, it'll become these little scorches that are these little creatures. And if they get too many of them happen, they'll gather together to create these phantoms or these large soot monsters. And so their duty is to keep things clean. And if they don't, these things get broke out. And they can affect the living dolls by kind of giving them a soot sickness, which makes them go crazy. And everything's for grandfather. Yeah, basically for the second season, a lot of focus is also in Kate wanting to create a rebellion. She wants to fight against the family. She doesn't like how things are set up. They have the whole reveal of the origins of the living dolls and the Shadow House family. And so she kind of wants to break the system. And so going into the second season, she's trying to get together a group. She's trying to figure out how to keep the living dolls from having to drink grandfather's coffee, because grandfather's coffee makes them obsessed with grandfather. The cloak figure. So your thoughts so far on the second season?
I'm at this point in this story where I can't turn back now. So I know that sounds bad, but it's really not. It's one of those that
you didn't like the cleansing scene.
No. This is a good thing.
The cleansing.
I promise this is a good thing. I actually am very seriously considering going farther than the anime at the end of this season. I'm really, really loving this show, this story. There's so many tidbits in here of characters and what grandfather's ultimate goal is and what these characters are actually doing. I'm just really getting to the point where I love it. It's just such a fascinating world that they've got going on. What is the whole idea of having these faces and all that stuff? I really, really want to dig into this stuff. It's really well thought out, it seems to me, and I really, really love it.
Yeah, the second season is going just as much as I would. I would say that the second season so far has been a little bit less intriguing as the first season, because I think the first season had the benefit of a lot of the big reveals being done in it. So getting into the second season really is just figuring out how to move around without being noticed. Because, again, she's technically trying to create a rebellion and trying to get together people that are going to be allies to her is a difficulty. Essentially, you're starting getting more into the Starbearers, because the Starbearers have the most, leeway for what they can do. So pushing to want to become a Starbearer is going to be a crucial thing. I do love a lot of the focus on Barbara and Barbie, and the Starbearers, and I think my only issue that I've had with the season so far is so much focus on somebody that's not even present. Like, they just are obsessed with talking about Christopher, and they keep showing these snippets of Christopher, and it's like, just show it or don't show it at this point, because I'm getting tired of talking about somebody that we're not going to talk about. I think that's the only thing that's been kind of the thing that's holding back this season so far is that aspect. But I am curious to hear more about Barbara. Honestly, yes, it's technically a partial because it's Ryuka Jimia, but I do want to learn more about Barbara. I do want to learn more about the Starbearers, but at the same time, it feels like a lot of talking about nothing. And I was really feeling like, for the longest time, like nothing was progressing. Like, I felt like this season was going to be a waste because as I think about, okay, what has actually transpired so far? Like, what exactly have we done so far with the season? And we're like, what, four, maybe five episodes into it so far? it really feels like nothing's happened. And so I'm feeling right now that this season is going to be a waste unless something happens soon. And so I am getting that feeling. I'm still loving every minute of it because I think it still, even though it doesn't go anywhere, this is one of those kind of settings and stuff that even if it spins its wheel, I'm still fascinated with the oddities in it. But I, to be critical, to be honest, I am feeling right now like we're not doing anything and I really want to do something. I think this recent episode did restore a little bit of my faith in it. Having Kate make her declaration was fantastic. I love seeing Emilico being angry walking forward. Such a dork. But I am honestly struggling with the fact that I feel like nothing has been really gotten into, even though we keep trying to get into things. So hopefully things will start picking up from this point on. But yeah, either way, I'm still loving the show. I still love the style of it. I still love the visuals. And the characters are fantastic. So I cannot wait for more. Even still, so yep, that's Shadow House second season. Definitely, either way, first season is highly recommended. So definitely check it out. All right, next show we have is Call of the Night or Yofu Kashi no Uta. This one's streaming on HIDIVE, running for 13 episodes, done by Studio Leiden Films. Source is a manga. Genres are romance, supernatural. This one, the director is Tomoyuki Itamura, who's done the Monogatari series and the Case Study of Vanitas. And the series composition by Michiko Yokote, who's pretty much done a crap ton of really fantastic stuff. So great, great team behind this one. This one follows Ko Yamori, who is essentially become a shut-in. It kind of shows a little bit of experience that he had in his school where some girl confessed to him. And he's like, you know, I don't know what love is, so I don't really want to get involved. And that kind of turns to him seemingly getting bullied by people because he turned this girl down. And so he decides to become a shut-in. And at some point, he is able to sneak out of his house at night and realizes the wonders and the freedom that is the night streets. Everybody's, you know, retired for the day. It's nice and empty, nothing but the, you know, the street lights illuminating the streets themselves. So he feels a little bit of a freedom, getting away from everything, getting away from the issues that he has during the day and all this kind of stuff. And eventually he runs into a vampire named Nazuna. He doesn't know that it's a vampire at first, but this Nazuna ends up kind of showing him the wonders of the night, going around, hanging out with some guys that are drunk on the street side, and eventually says, you know, look, I kind of help people like you, people that are having trouble sleeping and stuff, so come back to my place and I'll help you out. And so when they arrive there, she lays out this this bed in front of them and says, you know, lay down, I'll help you get some sleep. And as he's kind of laying there going, you know, this person's kind of weird, but at the same time, it doesn't seem like she's mean or dangerous or anything, so I'll just act like I'm sleeping, and eventually, you know, maybe she'll go to sleep and then I can sneak out or something. But then, yes, she goes and bites him, drinks his blood. And he's like, oh, that's a little weird. Am I going to become a vampire now? I mean, that'd be great. It seems like he enjoys the nightlife and stuff, so that'd be great if I could become a vampire. And she's like, no, that doesn't work that way. We don't create offspring just by biting people. What vampires do, obviously, to feed is to drink blood, and his seems to be extremely delicious to her. But they don't create offspring unless they make the person they're biting fall in love with them, or they fall in love with the actual vampire. So this kind of creates his whole driving force of, okay, I don't know what love is, but I need to figure out what love it is because I need to fall in love with this Nazuna, and then she can bite me, and then I can become a vampire, which would be great because, again, he enjoys the nightlife more than the daylife. So that kind of becomes the whole deal. Nazuna is a little weird in the idea that she loves making lewd jokes, but at the same time, when it comes to talking about love, she gets very flustered. So she's no help in him figuring out what love is. But over time, eventually, he ends up running into Akira, who is a childhood friend of his who is a little bit concerned for him because he's not been coming to school, obviously. She did enjoy being around him back when he was in school, and she has a little bit concern for him disappearing from school and kind of wants to get him back to going into school. And she learns about his whole experience trying to hang out with Nazuna and become a vampire. So you have the Call of the Night, which is Nazuna, and then you have the Call of the Day, which is Akira, obviously. But yeah, your thoughts on Call of the Night so far?
This show is so atmospheric, and I love it for that. I love the shots, the angles, everything about this show is just freaking beautiful. They have an absolute phenomenal touch to the lighting in a lot of cases, the just the overall ambience of this story is fantastic. Even when it comes to him wandering down the street and you get this sense of solitude that is like Andrew was talking about, how nice it is to be out during the night when it's kind of calmer, more chill, relaxing. And then even when you have the two Nazana interacting with Ko in these nighttime scenes, it feels very much just the two of them interacting with each other and you know finding each other in that situation. Nazana gives off this feeling of intrigue, which is absolutely integral to him wanting to become a part of the night with her, she gives off that mysterious vibe in a lot of the things that she does, and of course she has, like Andrew was talking about, that lewd nature to the way that she talks, which is more intriguing for him. So all these things absolutely come together in this just fantastic way it's presented, and I absolutely love it.
Yeah, I think the cool thing about this show so far has been they nailed this theme. They nailed the style. The style is so good. I love the character designs. I love the setting. I love the atmosphere that it creates, the music that goes along with it. Like, everything that Leiden Films and the team behind this is doing with what seems like a very atmospheric source material with what it's doing is perfect. Like, this show, visually, audio, and even the character acting itself is so perfect. Hats off to them. Great choice of music and everything. I love the theme song music as well. Everything's perfect in that regard. And then to add on to that, when that's the draw and initially is the style, that really does create this atmospheric feeling of isolation, and the freedom of isolation is perfect. It feeds into the story that Ko is, which is finding this place away from everything, finding this place where he can escape from the life that he's experiencing. And I love how they play that into the theme with what Nazana always kind of mentions, that those that do, you know, find themselves, you know, wandering around at night is really people that are unable to accept their day so far. Like, their day isn't satisfying quite yet. So they, you know, yeah, a lot of people, like the ones they meet, are going off and drinking at the bar because they feel like their day wasn't satisfied yet. And that was their way of finally putting a book into it. And that plays into him as well. He's not satisfied. He can't find that freedom that he's seeking. So it plays all that stuff very well. And I love the chemistry between Ko and Nazana is just so good. Like, some of the scene with the watch transceiver thing was just so perfect. Like, the chemistry and, again, the voicing between the two of them felt so natural and so fun and so playful. So they're nailing the chemistry between the characters. They're nailing the theme. They're nailing what it is, I think, to be somebody that just can't really... I kind of equate myself a lot to Ko and the idea of just feeling like I've always been a night owl. And I always feel like there's a silenceness to the night that you can't find there in the day. You don't have to worry about people bugging you. You don't have to worry about responsibilities. Everybody's sleeping, so thus you don't have anything pulling you left and right. And a lot of my work that I do for the podcast and the videos and stuff will sometimes be a lot at night because I don't have anything distracting me, and I can think a little bit easier. And that was the same case that I had with when I was working. A lot of the time I would work late just so that I can get stuff done that you can't do when phone's ringing and stuff like that. So I feel like a connection to Ko. The only thing that I don't really feel a connection with Ko is when it comes to him overthinking certain things, which I think is, it does bug me at times, but at the same time, I think we'll have, the writers so far show me that they'll have those punchlines eventually where things do sort of start making sense for the character, because he does overthink. Obviously, love, I think, is a little more difficult thing for people to understand. Friendships, I think he overthinks it sometimes. I think it does make sense when it comes to Akira, Asai and Ko's relationship. the idea that he never really seen her as a friend, even though she's seen him as a friend. The relationship they've had at school and the bonds that they have that have slowly fallen apart. Akira obviously mentions this idea that, you know, I don't, as time went along, I started realizing that I grew apart from certain people, and I didn't realize at the time that those friendships became diluted. And I can kind of agree with those, that sense, when you have certain friends that you, like my childhood friend that I had, I mean, if I call him right now, I probably would strike up a conversation, but technically not friends anymore. You technically have grown apart, and you don't really have those bonds you have anymore. You don't call each other on a regular basis and stuff. So there's a little bit of an agreement that I can have with that. But I think overall, what I've enjoyed the most has been the chemistry. These characters are so good together, and the writing is so perfect in that regard. I love how Nazuna always, again, is very forward with her ideas of, you know, lewdness and stuff like that. But then whenever it comes to love, she just freaks out, and she cannot stand any of it. And it did have me questioning at some point, like, I don't know. The way that they described, because typically with, like, vampires and stuff, it's always like you just have to bite and they become a vampire. And in some cases, it's you have to bite but not kill them, and then they'll become a vampire. And so when it gets into conversations like that, I'm like, I really do want another vampire to show up just so I can confirm that this is really how it works, because Nazuna is just super weird. And how she describes things is super weird. So it doesn't make full sense that is that really how it's going to be, or if it's something else that's involved with becoming a vampire. But she's an absolute goofball. I absolutely love her. I love the chemistry between the characters and how it plays out. And again, throwing in the style and everything is perfect as well. But no, I think the other thing that I really do love about Nazuna as a character, obviously because she looks like Touga from My Hero Academia, but I love her style and, again, how she's kind of portrayed. But it equally, I think as it goes along, and again, you do have these experiences between them, it does kind of open up the door to possibilities of, again, people have stated that this is kind of one of those shows where as you watch it, or at least the source material, as you go through it, it supposedly becomes a lot more than just cute vampire girls. And I'm really curious to see how that ends up playing out, because, again, how this writer's done so far with the setting and the chemistry and the characters, I'm really looking forward to what it does. Again, like I technically mentioned in this recent episode, they're kind of playing into the whole, while Nazuna's pulling him into the night, you do have Akira is kind of pulling him into the day. Like, she does want him to restore his previous friendships. He wants him to come back to school. And it's playing in those themes very well. And it's, again, while I felt like, especially early on with the whole friendship conversation, it was overstating it, it was overthinking it, I think it does technically come to a solid punchline. So I also like a lot of the stuff around Nazuna and technically creating that whole time gap there. She's like, here, I have a cell phone. She brings up this brick phone. I'm like, yeah, I remember those stupid brick phones. Most people watching this right now probably don't know what those are. Our father had one. It was fun. Got a huge kick out of it. But yeah, definitely looking forward to this. I also love when early on they were trying to figure out how they can communicate to each other. And at some point she's like, oh, I'm over here. I'm stalking some guy. Should I? I was going to drink their blood. And he's like, wait, you said early on that when you bite people, it's to feed, but it's also to produce offspring. So you're technically telling me that you're running off with some other guy to drink his blood, which is also technically how you do it. And so every time he shows his neck, like, you can drink my blood, she always goes like, oh my gosh, stop being so lewd, because that's like how they create offspring, is drinking blood. So every time he shows his neck, she gets all like blushy, because technically he's showing, in a sense, as Johnson. It's just, it's so dorky. I love the chemistry between the characters. It's so much fun. So I'm definitely loving the show a lot. Again, a lot to do with the style, presentation, chemistry. It all works together to a really fantastic show that I've been looking forward to every week. So, yeah. Highly recommend Call of the Night. It's definitely a gem. Super gem. So, moving on. Let's move to another gem. Rent a Girlfriend. Second season. Okonojo Okari Shimasu. Second season. This one's streaming on Crunchyroll. Run for 12 episodes. Done by Studio TMS Entertainment. The source is a manga. The genres are comedy, romance, school, shonen. This show, I don't I don't want to talk about it. Anyways, so yeah, for those that are, for some reason, don't know what Rent-A-Girlfriend is, essentially this guy, Kazuya, who gets broken up with his girlfriend, Mommy, and then decides that he wants to fill in that gap of being alone by using a rental service for a girlfriend. So he basically orders Chizuru to be his Rent-A-Girlfriend and goes out with her on a date and then falls in love with her and finds out that she's at his school. They have to keep it a secret, but at the same time, he can't really back down because he decided to bring Chizuru to his dying grandmother. And so he has to keep playing it out that he's, that they're in a relationship because her grandmother's really happy that he's found this great girl to be his girlfriend. And so, you know, lie becomes a worse lie that becomes a worse lie and spirals out of control until he can't, he's in over his head, basically. So, yeah, your thoughts on the second season?
Well, I'll save everybody a whole bunch of trouble. Me and Andrew still hate Kazuya, love the girls. Why I'm still watching this show is beyond me.
Yeah, I had to force myself to get caught up literally like the last 24 hours because I just don't want to watch the show. This is the sucky thing is because, yes, this is often referred to as the trash fire show of ever, and everybody apparently really, really loves it. And everybody obviously really, really loves it because it's trash fire, but it's not even that for me anymore. Like, I don't enjoy it. Like, there's nothing in it that's like, oh my gosh, I want to see this train wreck. It's at the point now where all I'm looking at is the side of the train slightly charred and I'm not getting anything out of it. Like, yes, it's always been with great characters. And I think this season so far with second season is so hitting heavy on Chizuru. It wants to sell us on Chizuru. And technically, I mean, we didn't get too much into detail about Chizuru and her life, and it really feels like second season is like, okay, this is Chizuru, this is what she's going through, and this is everything about her. We're definitely digging into her through and through. We're hearing about her past, we're hearing about her struggles, we finally get to see her actually doing what she wants to do, which is be an actress, and she's a phenomenal actress. Everything is about Chizuru, and it's fine. I think it's just the problem is that, similar with, and even worse than the first season, everything is about Kazuya and what's in his stupid head, and I can't take it anymore. Like, I literally cannot stand hearing him anymore, and I'm tired of him running in circles. This show just spends so much time having him think about the same thing over and over again. How many times do I have to hear him say he loves Chizuru, but she's just a rental girlfriend? I get it. I get the punchline. We don't have to say it every 2 seconds. I don't need to have him talk about how he needs to go get one out in the shower every 2 seconds. I don't care about Kazuya, and the show is nothing but Kazuya and what's in his dumb head. I joked about it, and I think Chris is already hitting on it before. I mean, Chris has hit on the idea that we had a struggle with Mommy because she's voiced by Aoyuki, and she's a B. And yes, my argument at the end of first season was that I think Chizuru is perfect for Kazuya because she's an enabler. She's enabling him to be the idiot that he is. And so, whatever, ship them together. I don't care anymore. I want the girls to be happy, like any harem, but I want them to be happy elsewhere. But at this point with the second season, as Chris was joking about the idea that Mommy's perfect for him because she's a B and he deserves to have a terrible life. And I'm more thinking the idea of, I'm now starting to think that Mommy, the way that she is probably because he's an idiot. So I kind of want them to be together. And now the fact they're kind of, they're not really going there. They might. They're kind of hinting at the idea of Mommy being like just straight yandere. Like she hates him. She was terrible to him, walked away from him. And now she's obsessed with him. It's like, do it. I want her to become yandere and kill him. And I'll be perfectly fine with it. That'll be the best ending ever because I cannot stand him anymore. And again,
after she sleeps with somebody in front of him, because yeah, why the heck not? Do that at the same time.
I mean, he does it in his mind all the time. Why not? But no, I'm at this point, I just can't stand the show anymore. Like, it's not fun. It's not terrible fun anymore. It's just, it's terrible at this point because it's not interesting. It's boring and it's frustrating every 2 seconds. This whole idea that he's super into Ruka brings it into his place and then sits there and talks about how he doesn't want to be around her and stuff. It's like, then tell her to go. Don't ask her to be your girlfriend and then talk about how you want to rent a girlfriend, Chizuru, and in your own head say that you're in love with Chizuru, but you can't touch her and at the same time drag her around. It's just, he's
He needs to be school aid at this point. I'm sick of it. He's the worst main character.
It's a boat.
The best part of the first season was Yoshiaki, his friend, beating the crap out of him because he's an idiot. And now we're doing another season of it, and I don't get the appeal anymore.
It's kind of frustrating because it's at one point I kind of tried to understand him, but I literally can't anymore. No. I'm at the point where I want to give the guy a little bit of credit for trying to grow, but he doesn't grow. It's one of those things of, like, Andrew had said, made the comment that Chizuru is enabling him, and it's one of those things of, it's really frustrating because I want to see him grow, and it doesn't seem like he's growing. He's doing the same things over and over and over and over again. This guy, when I use the term hot mess, I'm usually saying it in love of whatever they're doing. It's goofy and fun. No, this guy is a freaking horrible hot mess. Anytime he's on the screen, which is 99% of the time of the show, because the show is centered around him, I want to hit him. I mean, literally, I would probably, I hate to say this because I don't think I've hit anybody in my life, maybe a couple times with my brothers when we were really young, but seriously, this guy, it irks me in so many ways, it's not even funny. And I probably am going to let this one go. If I do, I won't review it, mostly because I don't want to torture anybody with it. Anybody who likes this show, all the power to you, because I literally, he irks the crap out of me.
No, the sad thing is that when here recently, there was a big hubbub because obviously one AnnieTuber said something about the manga, thus everybody started talking about it for once. Freaked out about something happening in the manga in the recent chapter, and I looked at it, and I'm like, oh, so nothing's changed. Like, and that's to your point. It's like, I understand that when we were talking about the first episode of the first season, our whole point was, yeah, a lot of people have been in that position. You have somebody you love, they dump you, and you're in a bad place, and you try to find some way of forgetting about it. It's a thing. But when you don't change ever for now, what, 16, 17 episodes, of all these things that happen, you're still making the stupidest decisions, and you're hurt. Not just that you're making stupid decisions, you're harming people around you. He's destructive to anybody that touches his life, and I don't like watching that. It's not fun anymore. I've gotten over that. Oh, this is funny. And now it's just, this is nothing. This is nothing. Oh, why am I even bothering with this show? So, and that's the troubling thing. Cause I think the thing about this show that is a selling point initially is not just the fact that there's all these cute girls, but the fact that there's such a great cast of, I mean, we have, again, Aoyuki, now Toyama, Ryo Takahashi, Sora Amamiya. I mean, these are like high caliber seiyus, and they're great character designs and everything. It's just, it's a crappy show. It will always be a crappy show, and I don't, at this point, I'm not getting the appeal anymore. I'm tired of it. So yeah, I'll probably end up finishing it just because AnnieTubers make this into a thing that's more popular than I think it should be, and you have to be part of the discussion. But I don't suggest it at all at this point. I if anybody asked me, should I watch Rent a Car, no, I don't think so. I just know
this is one of the shows that I would literally probably put a one on. I can't stand him he is ruining it so badly.
I'm at the point now where I just want to skip forward to all the cute girl parts and skip his inner dialogues every time it happens.
The Ruka scene was absolutely sweet. I loved it. But at the same time, every time he would open his freaking mouth or talk in his head, it would ruin the scene. And it was like, I'm here for Ruka. Shut up for 5 minutes.
I'm here for Natoyama. Shut up. Poor girl. They're all poor girls. That's the problem, because it's like we've talked about this before, but every harem, the appeal to harems has always been the girls. And then you root for the girls to get the main character because you want them to be happy, and you think, and then in their mind, being happy is being with the main character. This is the one of the few ones where it's like, no, I just want them all to leave him. please, every one of them, stay away from him. So, anyways, we're going to go for a second season.
He is not good for any of you baby girls.
Yes, please. I don't get your appeal to him. I really don't. Any guy can say that they root for you. Please don't get satisfied with a guy because of that. The Devil's a Part-Timer, second season, or Hatakaraku Mao-sama. Two explanation points is the Japanese title. This one is streaming on Crunchyroll. After 10 years, we finally have a sequel. This was back in 2013 when we have season one of this show. Of course, Studio 3Hertz has taken over from White Fox for the animation, which is a travesty, which we'll get into. But yeah, for those that are not familiar with this series that aired 10 years ago, it essentially follows Satan, or Mao, who is the demon lord of this one world. At some point, the heroes come in, and they are beating the crap out of him, and he decides to escape, basically. He opens a portal that comes to our world, where he essentially becomes a human, and he has to live as a human in Japan and get a job at not McDonald's. And the entire time, oh yeah, by the way, the hero followed him through the portal, so she's there too, and she's got to get a part-time job as well. And she's basically watching him, waiting for the moment that her powers comes back so that she can kill him. And then over time realizing, okay, he's not really doing anything bad, but I'm going to keep watching him in case he does something bad. And then, yeah, the church comes in after them. Satan's right-hand man basically comes in after him. And, yeah, all the while they're trying to make a living in Japan, keep peaceful, and at the same time, these people from the other world coming over to find out what's going on. So, yeah, and then the second season opens up, they have the My First Baby arc startup as this random baby suddenly appears out of nowhere, and they have to take care of her because she claims that the hero, Emmy, is her mother, and Mao is her father. So, in My First Baby arc starts. Your thoughts? I haven't watched the last episode, but I doubt it changed my opinion so far.
It's been a long time since I watched this show, so I've enjoyed some pretty much everything. It took a little bit of time to get kind of used to what characters were doing what and trying to remember what they did in the last season. So I'm very, very rusty on a lot of this stuff. But I've enjoyed everything I've been watching so far. The introduction to Anju, whatever, I don't remember her name. Ramius was absolutely adorable. Getting those characters kind of their hijinks of, well, you did this, but, you don't want to admit to it and all that stuff. It of course was fun. Loving it. Enjoy the kind of getting back into the swing of things. Of course, Chi-Chen is the best girl of all time. So we got that involved as well, but yeah, loving it.
I'm glad that Chris understands that Shiho is best girl.
Yes.
Even though this new studio has butchered her character design, I half the time don't know who she is. I think that's the only character that I'm, like, still thrown off by. I mean, Mao looks a little bit different. Emmy is really easy to tell who she is, and Susanoo is easy to tell. They're all easy to tell who they are. It's just for some reason, Chiho, what is the studio doing to her? She just does not look like Chiho. And we've talked about this before, but yes, Chris probably watched it back when it aired back in 2013. I didn't. I only watched the first season 3 weeks ago. So it's still fresh in my mind. And let me say, the first season, White Fox did an incredible job. Even to this day, that show looks better than most all the shows airing right now. That first season was so well done. The visually, character designs are always on model, and they had some really great action scenes. Studio 3Hertz? No, not doing as good. Dove definitely does not look as good. And again, I don't know why they couldn't keep the character designs the same, but being so fresh in the first season, out of the first season, it's bugging the hell out of me. So that's my biggest hang-up point. Other than that, like I said, I don't really care much for My First Baby arcs. I'm sure they'll probably get something interesting out of it. So far, what I've watched, again, the first two episodes, nothing has really happened so far. But I will say that I was kind of interested that it seems like, based on the OP and based on the first episode, it does look like they're possibly going to get into Mao and his history. Because one of the hanging storylines that I had with the first season was them acknowledging why Mao was doing what he was doing. And they technically hit on it a little bit with the first episode as well, saying now that Mao is over here and the demon army has kind of fallen apart, all the humans of that world are massacring all the demons, no matter what. Even if they're giving up, they're killing them. So it's obviously indicated that Mao in the previous world was probably trying to fight back against the demons being persecuted. And maybe he was rising up to take over all the nations because he wanted to stop that persecution from happening by wiping them out. And so now the reverse is happening. So my question mark has always been around Mao. And how the driving force for the hero of the first season was because she believed that Mao was responsible for her parents and her entire village being taken out. And the only interaction we had between the two of them regarding that conversation was, you're the reason that my father died. And his only response was, oh, I'm sorry. Like, what was that response? My question has always been, was it because the church took out our village? Was it because and claimed that it was Lucifer? Or was it a case of Mao had good intentions and it was to stop the persecution that was always happening against them? The, you know, revenge because revenge. Or is it a thing where Mao himself technically is different in that world? Because now he's in our world, he's now human. Does that mean that he no longer understands why he did what he did because he's no longer this evil demon lord anymore? That's the stuff that I'm really curious if they'll eventually get into with the season. Because honestly, with the first season, I loved the first half. Like, the first half was perfect. The chemistry was perfect. The writing was perfect. I loved all the comedy sketches they had. Like, when they had to go to the police booth, who did they call? Oh, the person they signed down as his guardian. Ooh, who's that? Emmy, the hero. So she's like, I'm literally here to kill you, and they're calling me to be your parental guidance to come in and let you out. Do you realize how embarrassing that is to me? Like, the chemistry was so perfect. And then the second half, just, it fell off. Like, it became so standard trope slice of life that it kind of ruined it for me. Like, the action scenes towards the later part was still good. So my hope is that we get back to that same chemistry and that writing that the first part of the first season had. And honestly, with the introduction of my first baby, it seems like, again, well, let's bring in another trope. Are we going to keep doing the tropes and that's it for this series and I'm never going to enjoy it again or what? So that's got my issue right now, is I don't like the studio. The studio kind of has butchered my favorite character's art style. It doesn't look as good and it's not doing anything so far besides showing, oh my God, one of the things I hate the most about the second part of the first season was Ezeal and his being sick every two dang frames. And now I'm seeing him being tired because obviously he's taking care of the baby. And now it's like, oh, we're doing this crap again. We'll see. I don't really have much else to say about that. We'll see. Hopefully it gets better, but so far nothing. And again, I've only watched two episodes, so I missed the third. We'll see if it makes this great comeback after 10 years. Moving on. Overlord. Let's talk about something fun. Overlord third season. No, fourth season. Overlord season 4. This is streaming on Crunchyroll, done by Studio Madhouse. Source is a light novel. Genres are action, adventure, fantasy, game, magic, supernatural, everything pretty much. I don't know why anybody would not know this story, but essentially if you don't, it follows a guy named Amonga. Well, he's a gamer who one night stays up as the servers are going down. They're shutting down this game, and he's like the one of the last people to stay online. And when the time clucks to the point where the servers are going to go down, he's still in there. He's been transported into this world as the skeletal lich lord that he is, his avatar in this world. So he's obviously trying to figure out why he's stuck there and checking out how things have kind of changed a little bit since this whole happened, because it seems like all the, you know, guardians, NPCs that they made inside of this big lair that he and his guildmates made are all acting a little bit differently. He's trying to discover skills in this world, figure out if there's any other players in the world, and eventually leads to him pretty much trying to create his own utopia. That's pretty much what we're going into with the fourth season, is he's now trying to create his own utopia. So just in case his guildmates ever return to this world, or he finds where his guildmates are, if they're in this world, that he'll have this place created and they can all enjoy it together. So, and kind of get rid of persecution and stuff that's in this world, obviously, because nobody likes his existence because he's a lich and every one of his guards are basically monsters of some sort. So your thoughts so far on season 4?
I think I missed an episode or two, so not.
You've missed episodes of Overlord?
Yeah.
How dare you?
It was nice to see them all come back. That's for sure. It didn't, But what I was watching, it didn't really set up anything per se. I mean, we had basically Momonga walking through the town, and he's setting up laws or something like that. So I think
Demiurge is set up the rules. No, that's the funny thing is, like, so far it's set up that he wants to create this utopia. He wants to dominate all these kingdoms. But at the same time, he doesn't know how to run them. So he's divvying out to everybody. So every time somebody asks him, like, well, so how should we handle these things? I mean, you probably know what would have to happen. They go, yes, you're right. That would have to happen. And so they would make up something and he would just agree with it because he literally has no clue what he's doing.
He's been doing that the entire show.
It's so great. Every time somebody suggests something, he's like, yeah, of course I would have done with that. Good job. And they get so super happy.
But yeah, as it stands right now, I'm loving it, but at the same time, I'm quite a bit behind. So this is one of those that is falling behind.
Yeah, it's been fantastic so far. Definitely love seeing the return of this show. The thing that kind of drew me in initially to Overlord as a series is, yes, it's another isekai, but the different thing that it was doing was that it had such a dark theme to it. It's super dark in setting. It's got that feeling that you're technically following the big bad, like the big boss bad of that particular world. Even though he's not necessarily going out and being a demon lord or anything like that, it's just that anytime somebody sees him, they're obviously going to see him as a threat because he's a gigantic undead lich. And the kingdoms don't like his existence and everything. So he's technically the bad guy, but he's not trying to be the bad guy. But the thing that I've always enjoyed about it was that fact that he's becoming what he is. So yes, he was a normal human playing a video game character, but now that he is inside of the body of this lich, he's losing senses of human nature. He's losing humanity. He's losing compassion, stuff like that. When things terrible happen in front of him, he would always be like, I should be bothered by this, but I'm not. And that was always the cool thing early on that I liked. But then the thing that kind of drew me in further was, again, the theme and these great characters. Like, every character around Momonga are super fascinating. Shaltir, I've always struggled with Albedo. I'm fine with her, but at the same time, the derpy face too much, I get like, ugh, okay. But, like, Kyokutis. I don't know why I have trouble saying that. Kikutis, Demiurge, even like a lot of these other side characters, like the princess and her crazy nature. We had the butler and Suare, which I absolutely love their story. There's every character this story has so far presented. Even the lizard people. We had like an arc with the lizard people that was like, why are we doing this? And then it turns into something super cool at the end. This writer knows how to create characters and make them all significant in some way. And as we get into this season, it's like we're seeing all of them kind of branching out to handle something for Momonga to create this utopia. And they did really well in kind of reintroducing those characters while at the same time keeping the story progressing. Because what is now is, it seems like his goal right now is to use adventurers of this world to branch out. Because one of the things he's always been trying to do from the very beginning was learn about the skills of this world, but also try to find his friends. And so now he's kind of using the adventures of this world to branch out. And I think that might turn into something pretty fascinating going forward. But obviously the other thing is to take over all these kingdoms and have this big utopia that nobody can stand up against, which obviously nobody would ever be able to.
Yeah, that was one of the last things I seen was him trying to take over the Adventurer Guild or something like that.
Yeah, he pretty much presents to them like, I want you to work for me. And he's like, well, we don't work for the kingdoms because we want to stay, you know, neutral. And he's right. Like, well, and I like how he does this. He's like, well, okay, well, at this kingdom over here, that kingdom persecutes elves, but you don't stand up against that, right? Even though you technically serve them. It's like this idea of pointing out that they do technically go by their laws, but if you're neutral, why would you go by their laws? I liked how he kind of threw that right back in his face because it was a simple way for him to show, look, I don't want you to just give up the guild and disband. I want you to work with me. And he's actually turned out to be a really fantastic character for him because it's the only person next to him that will tell him, no, you shouldn't do it this way. Everybody else is like super like subservient to him. Anything he says is law. And if they ever disagree with him, they would probably go, you know, take out their own life because they would have disgraced themselves before the great Momonga. So yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing where it goes from here. The animation is still fantastic. The fight with what was his name? The fight in the arena was absolutely fantastic. Great animation, and again, great style to it. So Madhouse is still doing a phenomenal job with the series. So yeah, I can't wait for it. Every single week is phenomenal. So it's just a great series with great characters that has. I think of all the isekais, this one's I think the best one for characters. It's just it does it so well, and it does dark really good. So hopefully this arc itself turns out to be something interesting. I think they've kind of hinted at these dwarves that he has to go check out, so I think that's the arc they're doing here is going to see the dwarves, but that might just be them hinting at something for another arc. Who knows? There's so many branching like arms going out right now that it's hard to keep track of exactly where they're going. So yep, Overlord season 4 still phenomenal. Orient part 2, or Orient Awajishima Gekito Hin. This one is streaming on Crunchyroll, running for 12 episodes, being done by Studio ACGT. Sources of manga, genres are action, fantasy, and of course this is by the creator Shinobu Otaka, who did Magi. So there you go. This basically takes place in a world where demons or oni suddenly appeared and took over the world and basically turned all the humans into their servants and forced them all into these mining towns where they have to mine up ore and materials to feed to the oni. And there was people that were fighting against them, which were known as the Bushi. And the Bushi were samurais that fought against them. There was this great war that happened. But now we're to the point now where they've almost pretty much failed. And all the people, all the citizens, all the humans are pretty much brainwashed into believing that, you know, the Oni are good people and the Bushi were just creating a war that was causing, you know, devastation and hardships. So to be a Bushi in most countries, which they haven't really hit on at all since the first part, the idea of being a Bushi is kind of, you'll get you looks and people will look down upon you. So, but we followed Musashi and his friend Kojiro, who they're... Kojiro's father was like a Bushi and kind of instilled that upon him, and Musashi wanted to be one too. So after breaking out of their village, they make a Bushi band where they go out and find Oni and take them out, even though Musashi is incredibly crappy. But at some point they end up going to this one town where there's like this kind of ritual where they put all these swords, these Bushi swords, and they're able to, you know, pick it up and see if the sword itself will accept them. And we kind of find out that Musashi has got like this great onyx goddess thing inside of him that everybody wants. And and eventually he finds some poor girl inside of a weird monster pod, and they go off to the Uesugi band, which is currently calling out to people to go out to fight one of the biggest onis out there. So that's kind of in where we're going right now. So I think the big question everybody's asking, Chris, right now is this show getting good? Because the first part, obviously, a lot of people were, and I mean, us too, we were like, you know, maybe it's just going to take some time to build up something. Do you think it's there yet?
Yes and no. It's one of those things that, like Andrew was going through the sequence of events, we've talked about what makes a shonen a shonen, and trying to break that down into its kind of... nature, and this is one of those things that kind of you can see almost the formula playing out as you're watching through Orient. You've got the main character. The main character has his buddy. He's in a small village.
The main character has a super overpowered ability within himself that he can't use all the time.
That came out towards the end of this last season. I was getting to that. He was in this small village. He's fighting this thing, and then the world opens up, and then he goes to that first town that where he met the girl. And she kind of introduces the
Ryu Takahashi.
Some of the
Ryu Takahashi.
And this is the thing that you can see, and as Andrew was talking about, after we got Tsumugi, you went to the next part where you see the swords, and then you find out that Musashi has this internal superpower. And you go farther and farther and farther, then you're starting to see more and more factions. You have the good guys, quote unquote, the good guys, and each of the good guys has their squads or whatever have you. And then over the other side, you have another faction who is the neutral that is, are they good or are they bad? And then you have the Onis, who are obviously the bad guys. So all these things are playing out. As we're getting into this season, there's one aspect about this show that seems to be kind of not repetitive in nature, but it bogs the show down quite a bit. It kind of gets stuck in these moments from here to here and there. It kind of gets I almost want to look up to see if Orient was written before Sinbad or not Sinbad, Maji, because it seems like when I last season when we were going through it, I remember pointing out I trusted this writer based on Maji, that he had this really good solid ability to write a good solid shonen. And this, it's almost like this was the one where they learned how to do things. And so I give it credit in the aspect of it is doing good. It's just, it doesn't feel as refined as Maji did at all.
This one's way after. So about 10 years after, 9 years after Maji.
Huh. Orient was after Maji?
Yeah.
Wow.
I think Maji is done, isn't it? I think Maji is completed.
But well, not the anime, the show. The source.
Huh. I think the problem I'm having so far with part two is that it's a lot of characters. Like, we're just introducing character after character after character after character after character. Now, they've technically settled down with this last episode and kind of just started pinning Musashi with some people. But then it's just kind of flipped on its head at this point, so it doesn't matter anyways, because whatever bonds he could have made with those people are suddenly gone at this point. They'll probably reestablish them later, but whatever possibility of, you know, grouping with certain people has been thrown out. I think the biggest problem that I have with this show so far is I don't mind a slow burn shonen, which just really does feel like a slow burn shonen. It does really feel like we're trying to go after a really big pinnacle, because the way they describe it is that, of course, you have all the... Everything is kind of a branch down. So you have, like, the source Oni, like, the big one. And then you have, they made, like, four or something bigger. Like, just this semi-less bigger Oni. And those ones have branched out to others. So they're birthing down, like, almost like a family tree. And as they birth down, they're weaker and weaker. And so the idea of taking down one of the big ones is a huge thing. Like, we're chopping off a key source branch of this big tree. And so... It seemed like we're already trying to go for a big bad, and that could be a huge stepping stone for the story itself to kind of progress. But so far, there's a couple of issues here. One being that the animation's crap. Like, ACGT is just doing very... This is like... It was early last year. I made a video talking about the death of the old shonen, which is the idea that anything shonen going forward was going to be... In order to capture people's attention, is going to have to be at the level of things like My Hero Academia and Demon Slayer, stuff like that. These new shonens that are coming out that are looking incredible while being slow burn shonens. Jujutsu Kaisen's another example. And this is like a shonen coming back and saying, "Hey, we're still doing the shonen thing," and everybody's looking at him going, "But the shonens look like this now. Why are you still looking like garbage? Because you know that you're going to be running for a long period of time." I just don't feel like it is a slow burn, not looking good, and at the same time, not really progressing the characters well enough is getting frustrating. And now being, 16 episodes in at this point, Musashi is still a useless piece of garbage that has done literally nothing, is frustrating me at this point. I'm not seeing him progressing. I'm not seeing him getting better at all. Yes, he got a cool sword, and it's made him overpowered for a couple minutes, but he as a character is not doing anything, and he's still terrible, and he still sucks, and he hasn't grown at all.
He doesn't have the same we've made jokes about Goku before. He's in some ways he's annoying, and he wants to fight everybody. Okay, that's his shtick. Musashi doesn't have the for a lack of a better term, he doesn't have the charisma of Goku, who where you're like, yeah, he's annoying, but at least you like him. He's likable. When it comes down to it, Musashi is kind of just obnoxious, annoying, and then when somebody kicks him with a weird sword shoe, you go, you deserved that bump.
Well, his whole driving force is everything that his sensei told him. So it's, we should all band together and fight together.
Yeah.
And then somebody throws it in his face and he doesn't really have anything to retort. It's like, at least tell him why you believe that. I mean, the guy literally called you a liar because you did exactly what the girls want you to do. But at the same time, you can't say that by your own admission. Like, you can't say that by your own words.
Yeah.
You could have argued that, but you failed. like, what is your purpose here? I give that. That is shonen fair. Naruto and stuff like that, that's always been the case where you have, right, here is the actual people that are good. Naruto sucks. Yes, he had a quirk that made him powerful, but in the grand scheme of things, all these commanders and stuff were the powerful ones. And they're doing that with this one. When it comes to them actually having to fight, the commanders are kicking butt, and he, right, looks like an idiot, and he shouldn't even be there. So it does make you question, like, why even bring these people here? Like, why even bring Musashi? Just, you guys should have kicked him back at that, over there. But,
well, and to be fair, he's learning something in this process. He's learning about the chains, linking, and all that stuff. Rather. Yeah, it's important that he learns this stuff, but it doesn't come off as. I liked the way that Majin,
even though they basically have stated that he can't link with anybody. They've set it up as that being the case. He can't link with other people except for obviously one person. Spoilers, but he can't link with people. So it's like, so is he even going to be able to link with Kojiro and Tsugumi later? I mean, is he going to figure out how to not have that be an issue? I don't know. It's a lot of character introductions and a lot of really not good animation. The combat sequences are kind of boring because the animation sucks. I don't know. At this point, I don't know. I'm watching it for Takahashi.
Me personally, I'm just in this middle of the road. I'm enjoying it for what it is, but when it comes down to it, I'm not screaming off the roofs that, hey, go watch Orient. It's the best shonen ever. It's not. It's just what it is, and I'm enjoying it for what it is.
Yeah, I've always liked the character designs, though, because that's Magi. That's Shinobu Otaka. So that's Orient part two. Moving on, we have a couple cocos. I guess just give our thoughts on how the show's panning out so far, because we're like, I don't know, 14, 15 episodes in at this point. Mid-season impressions. But yeah, this one is streaming on Crunchyroll, running for 24 episodes. My gosh, I can't believe that. Synergy SP is working on it with Shinny Animation. But yeah, this one essentially follows Nagi as he is told by his parents that, oh yeah, by the way, you were switched at birth. Oops. We're going to go meet your actual family or your actual parents, which are actually these really rich people. And they have our daughter, which we were supposed to raise. And then they come to find out the way the parents figure that they can still see their children because they have to switch them back is by having them married, even though they're technically almost the age of just going out on their own anyways. I still don't get that part, but whatever. So yeah, they want to get him to get married. And yeah, so you kind of have Nagi figuring out his new parents. Not really, actually. He hasn't really spent any time with his parents. Him having to live with this Erika, who is his old parents' actual daughter. Him being upset about being assigned a marriage because he really likes this girl, Hiro Sagawa, who is his classmate that he's been competing with to make her acknowledge him by getting better grades than her. And then also, yeah, by the way, since you're not really blood related to Sachi, his sister, she's now madly in love with him now. So, yeah, harem ensues, living together on their own. What are your thoughts?
A character that I don't hate, and it is not destroying the show for me.
Yeah, not too bad.
It's
a little dense, but
yeah, I'm generally enjoying myself watching the show. I like the girls. The girls are doing pretty good in my book. It's one of those hot, warm, and then cold. The only thing that I don't much care for is that we're putting a lot of focus on certain characters and not the other ones. And it's one of those things of Sachi. We're now that we're finally getting into her, her, we're going in and she's like super hot on him, and we're, it would be nice to actually get some kind of breakdown of why it is that that she likes him so much. Obviously,
because he's the main character. That's all harems have to do.
Well, yeah, that's true. When it comes down to it, yeah, I get that he's a hard worker, and that's a lot of the reason why a lot of the girls do eventually seem to be at least acknowledging him. Her being the one that's known him the longest, she would be the one that should have the most reasons why she likes him. So when it comes down to it, it's one of those things that I want to give him more time to get to a point, a reason. Granted, to be fair, I think 2 or 3 episodes behind still. I did get caught up on a lot of it, but I was catching up on a lot of shows at the same time. So, and this is one of the ones that I still had like 2 or 3 more episodes to get on. And I know that the last things I was watching, Sachi was being shoved into the forefront, and we were getting a real big breakdown, and he ultimately acknowledged something that she really wanted to be acknowledged. So, that's where I'm at this moment, and I am loving it. I kind of want a little bit more of Hiro. Erica has been thrown to the wayside. I don't even know why she's in there half the time, even though she's like the obviously the cover girl.
She's a poster child.
Yeah, she's the cover girl. We need to be getting something from her. So yeah,
she's dumb, and he has to help her study. That's tons. And oh yeah, she has a secret that if he knows about, will change his life. She has the key. If
you watch, she has the key. Obviously,
they all have the key.
So yeah, and when it comes down to it, I'm liking it. I wish we could get them and get more of the girls, but they got to take their turns with them. And hopefully we'll have a solid resolution towards the end of this. So yeah,
this show is extremely boring. Unfortunately, I don't think it's a bad show, but at the same time, as I was trying to get caught up here a week ago, I was like, I had to tell Chris at some point, I'm like, I'm sorry, but this show is extremely boring. Like, it doesn't have the harem hijinks, but once every now and then, the characters aren't... The problem that this show has is that it has a really bad first impression, because I honestly believe that every one of these characters early on were annoying in some way. Erica was annoying because she was the rich girl that is completely oblivious to how the world works. Hiro was overly obsessed with... Or Sagawa was overly obsessed with... you know, grades and competing with him. Everything had to be a competition. And then guess what? It chills out. Like we stop having Erika Amano obsessed with, you know, being an idiot about anything in life. At some point, Sagawa stops being obsessed with competition and everything. At some point, no, Imano still is obsessed with him. That's all about her only quirk. I don't know. This show just doesn't really have anything happening. It feels like nothing's happening. Every now and then, suddenly out of nowhere, at the end of an episode, they'll punchline of saying, Erica will say, I have a secret that if you know this thing that I'm looking for, it'll change your life forever. This other episode has a punchline with the father looking at this photo that has, obviously, this is a big question mark, what's in this photo. Every now and then, it tries to throw in something that's like significant to their lives, and then it goes back to just Nagi is studying, or Erica needs help with studying, or Sachi wants to be acknowledged, or yeah, it's just, it feels like this show has nothing in it, and I'm not getting anything out of it, and I can't figure out why, other than just the writing being not really there. So I don't know, it's fine, but at the same time boring for me. So yeah, there you go, couple cocos. It sucks because I'm this far into it, I might as well finish it. Hopefully the big reveal is cool. I don't know. They all have a key. I don't know. Cuckoos. Prima Doll, the next one. This one is streaming on High Dive, running for 12 episodes. This one is being done by Studio Bibbury Animation Studio. Source is a multimedia project. Dramas are comedy, drama, slice of life. And of course, this is from the creator. The creator behind this is Key Studios, which of course is known for doing Clannad, Little Busters, Angel Beats, all those big visual novels. Character designs by Yui Hara, who's known for doing Kirono Mosaic. This one takes place in a world that seems like this war has just settled down. There's still some kind of tension still there, but overall, this war is kind of over. During that war, the humans were utilizing these things known as Mechanica, which are these robots that would fight the war for them. And additionally, they also had these automata, which were these very beautiful women that would, or girls that would essentially control all those Mechanica. So you could have this one automata that's able to control a massive army of Mechanica and send them out to war. So again, following the war, it seems like all these Mechanica and all these automata had to be basically dissembled and taken apart as kind of a sign this war is over. But this one cafe owner, Nagi Toma, has decided to essentially rebuild the girls and make them serve at his cafe and serve people food and whatnot. And we follow Haizakura, who is one such of these automata that just wakes up in the basement after being kind of reprogrammed. And she quickly, like, figures out, well, okay, well, let's go up to the surface, sees a cafe, that's great, walks outside, ends up meeting this little girl named Chiyo, getting a little bit of an idea of what's going on there, and then eventually stops this Mechanica from going rampaging, and then passes out, wakes up, gets kind of filled in on what's going on by Nagi, who offers her to work at this cafe, and then over time, we're kind of meeting each of these girls that work at the cafe, and what their duties are, and learn how to work at the cafe, because she's kind of a moe blob, so she doesn't do things properly. And get into each of the character stories and what their kind of connection is to the war itself. So, and again, the entire time there's this looming threat that this group, this faction, is trying to restart up the war, and Gekka snipes him because Gekka's a sniper, little lolly sniper Gekka. So, your thoughts so far? Is Key making you cry yet?
No, but I'm sure that it will at some point.
You don't think that... You did not cry at... oh my gosh, I can't say her name. Houkuboshi. The silent girl. You didn't cry for
that
episode?
Yeah, I did. Well, I teared up a little bit.
It got me teared up.
it's one of those that I think that they're doing so fantastic. At some point on Discord, somebody was pointing or was talking about this, and I had pointed out that it seems like this is going to be in the direction of, but it was only based on like two episodes, so I wasn't really sure. And now I'm almost positive that this is the direction that they're going, is fix a robot, tell the robot story. And in the telling the story of the robot, you're going to see more of the world and how the war played out and all that involved in that. And I think that this is an excellent way of, because one of the problems in some cases with getting the story through another character is technically the issue of a flawed storyteller. And in a way, these being robots, you may still have a flawed storyteller in a way. But in another aspect, technically robots cannot lie, so you will have a better aspect of having the truth. So it plays an interesting tidbit in this recording of the war and telling the story from their perspective. So it's giving a really interesting tidbit of this, and I really do enjoy it for what it is. We get the cute girls doing cute things, and still there's that dark contrast in the background. That is, that's Key in a nutshell. So, I do love what I've watched so far, and I can't wait to see more of it for sure.
We all get to wait until we find out what crazy story is behind Haizakura, because Haizakura is like the only one that doesn't really have any knowledge of where she. I mean, technically Yuguri too, but that was a different case. But Haizakura is the only one that really doesn't know anything about what she was before. All the other girls have been able to retain what knowledge they have of what transpired in the war itself. And in some cases, it kind of affects them personally. Gekka believing that she cannot have emotions. I can't say her name. Boshi, silent girl, has issues with the fact that she couldn't sing or speak anymore because of her whole story. But no, I think, okay, so let me get the bads out of the way. I love Key stuff a lot. And I think a lot of what makes Key great is that they take time to dive into characters for over an extended period of time, so you can get the build up to what they are. You get used to them, you hear a little bit about them, you get a hint of what their issue is, eventually leading up to the point where the big reveal happens, and then you cry your eyes out. That's Key. That's what Key does good. what they're doing wrong with Prima Doll is they're doing a character per episode. And so we get a whole episode for Gekka. Find out what her issue is. Punchline. We get a whole episode with Boshi. We find out what her issue is. Punchline. I can't get that connection, that buildup in one episode. And so I think that's where the usual flavor of Ki is failing miserably. Now, again, Boshi's story broke me. I still got emotional at the end. And I think that was really around what was portrayed was this bigger story that was tragic. Technically, with Yogiri, it was a little bit, was also a sort of a struggle for me as well, and emotionally, because I felt that idea that Yogiri wanted to be, wanted to fulfill what Chiyo wanted, but she knew that she couldn't. Like, I had this desire to make this person happy, and I can't. I will eventually cause sadness. I can't do that. So it does have good storytelling in there. It's just, it doesn't give enough time to sit to where it has an emotional impact. What I feel like they're doing is with 12 episodes, what they're trying to do is go, let's get through all these girls quickly, so that we can have this big moment for the second half where, I don't know, the war gets stirred up again and the girls have to go out and fight. That's all I feel like they're doing, is trying to rush to these characters to get to the bigger storyline, which sucks. They should have left the war, whatever this bigger storyline is going to be, out of the picture and focus on spending 12 episodes with four characters. Let us build them up. Let us get into their stories and let them actually develop as characters. Don't just rush into their punchlines so quickly, because I don't get that emotional connection with them. So that's really what this show is struggling with me so far. Negatives out of the way, Bibbury Studios is doing a phenomenal job. These characters look absolutely gorgeous, very beautiful, very vibrant, which really does really well to stick out in this kind of post-war era where everything's kind of a little bit flat. So the characters look fantastic. They're keeping them on model. They look absolutely adorable. Again, Haizakura is an absolute moe goofball. So it's playing all that stuff out great. And even, again, with my shortcomings with the storyline and how fast they're rushing through it, the stories themselves are still impactful. They still have these really great punchlines. Boshi is a good example. This idea of, you know, these people essentially seeing her as this kind of, essentially the war idol. The person that can bolster the army because she's so beautiful and she has this great voice, sing for us. And then that turning into tragedy and causing her not to be able to speak was a really cool punchline. Again, I would wish it would have gone on maybe two episodes so that you can build into it. Let us take some time with her, with the soldiers. Let us get connected with the soldiers and then go to that punchline. Don't just say, assume there were all connections. Assume they had a relationship. Assume they had a friendship. Again, I'm not going to get back into that, but visually looks great. Characters look great. The stories themselves, even though they're really short, they're still solid stories. I'm liking the chemistry so far, and I'm looking forward to more of the episodes. I still love the show in the end. So yeah, I just wish I had more time to work with, honestly. But that's Prima Doll. Check that out if that's interesting. If you want to cry, check that out. Lucifer and the Biscuit Hammer, Ohoshi no Samidare. This one is streaming on Crunchyroll. I think there was some whispers about it going two core, but I think it's only going a single core, but we don't know yet. Studio is Naz. The source is a manga. The genres are action, adventure, comedy, drama. And of course, this is the one behind, the creator behind the series. The source material is Satoshi Mizukami, who's known for doing Planet With. So this one takes place, it follows a guy named Yuhi Amamiya. And Yuhi, at some point, ends up waking up to a lizard on his chest. And he quickly chucks the lizard out the window. The lizard shows up at his side again, basically telling him, hey, look, you are the chosen lizard knight. You're going to be, I have chosen you. You're going to fight to protect the princess. So, you know, get stronger. Let's go find the princess. And he just keeps chucking him out the window. It doesn't want to have anything to do with this weird lizard. And he thinks that he's hallucinating. Eventually he discovers that he's been given a sort of power, which is the ability to kind of create or control gravity within this little field. And at some point ends up being attacked by this golem. The golem almost nearly kills him, but then this girl, Samidare Asahina, shows up. One punches the thing out of existence and saves his life. And oh yeah, turns out this is not the princess. She's not the princess. She has the princess's spirit within her. And so she's been designated as the princess. He's been designated as the lizard knight. There's also these other knights that eventually will show up. And all these knights' purpose is to protect the princess or Samidare and eventually stop this gigantic hammer that you can't notice until you know it's there. This gigantic hammer that will one day be used by the evil mage to destroy the world. Now, the twist that kind of comes very quickly is that we kind of find out that Samidari Hasahina, her goal is to stop the hammer in order to destroy it herself. She wants to destroy the world herself. She doesn't want anybody else. She loves the world so much that she doesn't want some other person destroying it. Her whole idea process is that she loves the world so much and she knows that eventually she will pass away, that she does not want the world to no longer be hers, so she wants to destroy it before she dies. So, weird, but that's this writer. Eventually we end up meeting one of the other knights, which I think was the wolf or dog knight or whatever. I think it was a wolf knight. I don't remember what it was, but he's like this superhero justice. And even though Samidari Asahina's words of wanting to destroy the world or protect the world in order to destroy it resonates with Yuhi, he kind of describes it as her words being that of like a Lucifer being able to kind of manipulate him. He's so like diehard to in order to help her succeed with her world and her desires because he hates the world, that this new hero is kind of a threat to them. So anyways, your thoughts?
I didn't watch it.
You didn't watch it? It's Planet With writer, Chris.
I know. I've got other shows that I'm trying to keep up on.
So yeah, I'm not going to go there. Just joking. Yeah, this show is great. And I know this is getting blasted by negativity, which is fine. I understand people's issues. Obviously, coming into the show, I was super pumped because Planet With writer. Planet With was a series that managed to make me see something very typical from the beginning and slowly peel away the onion layers or whatever, the layers of the story, and just do crazy things with the characters I wasn't expecting from the very beginning. This writer knows how to do twists and turns. He knows how to make dynamic characters, characters that turn with each turn, or change with each turn. So when I got into the show, yes, obviously, from the get-go, Studio Naz really hate the fact that Studio Naz is working on this. Studio Naz is... we've said several times before, most all the shows with Naz we're interested in, but in the end, Naz falls apart. Naz is not a good studio. They've always butchered so many shows, not by this, you know, ruining the source material, but just not animating very well. And they're not animating this very well. And I think that's why a lot of people shut off very quickly from the show, is that the action scenes just aren't there. It's just a lot of stills, sliding stills, and stuff like that. What keeps me going with the show, again, is Mizukami's writing. So when I do come into the show and it does feel like a little bit weird, okay, here's the guy that's been selected by the random mascot character to become the hero to protect the princess and save the world from the big, huge hammer. I know based on Mizukami's previous work with Planet With, or it's technically his later work, but for me, watching adaptations, based on Planet With, I know this writer knows how to twist characters on a regular basis. And I'm already seeing that with the show. When you have these things like Yuhi and his struggles with his grandfather, has grandfather treated him terribly, and how that technically affects him to accept somebody's honey-covered words like Samidare, seeing her as almost this Lucifer character that's able to manipulate him into following him into destruction, makes sense for me, and I'm really curious how they can kind of bend that going forward. And they're already kind of doing that. They're really taking Amamiya and taking him down this really terrible route, where, again, seeing that this hero of justice, this other knight, would possibly see her wanting to destroy the world in the end is a bad thing, he's willing to already start to think about, well, I can technically use Samidare's sister as a hostage because he's in love with her, and then I can kill him. He's already contemplating killing people to protect the desires of his princess. And the way they're kind of slowly moving into that stuff is fascinating to me, and I'm really curious to see what they do with that stuff next. The other cool thing they're kind of already presenting is that technically they've already hinted at this not being the first time. Noi Kasant, his lizard, the one that his mascot, the thing that empowers him, Noi Kasant is technically has mentioned once before that I don't want to fail midway through just like last time. He doesn't know why he said that, but there's an indication that this isn't the first time this has happened. And so I'm already speculating right now certain things, like where they could possibly go, who's technically the evil mage that they have to stop, all that kind of stuff. And again, technically, the dreams that he's having has already kind of started. This dream that he keeps having, he's at this plain area that looks like it's out in space, and there's this big door, and he meets with the princess there. I'm assuming it's the princess. That's my theory, he meets with the princess there to talk about what's happening during the day. So again, I love how this writer slowly reveals things. And again, how he takes certain concepts that seem very normal, like, oh, here's a superhero, and turns it on its head. And that was something that I similarly have happened with Planet With, that I'm excited to see what happens with this one. And the source material has had, like, super high ratings. A lot of people are super fans of the manga, so it does have me having high expectations for this one. I'm honestly, each week, watching the show, then checking Mizukami's tweets, seeing what he's kind of said about each episode, because he's already mentioned things like, wow, they took out the panty shot here. That's kind of weird. He's already mentioned aspects of, like, animation issues, but he really wants to support the studio. And hearing what his thoughts are on how things have changed from the manga has been interesting, because, like, they completely took out a character, which he admits had no point to the story. So he was perfectly fine with them taking it out. And I'm also looking at the manga at the same time to see what differences they have there as well. It's been pretty spot on, again, besides the notes that he's made about things have changed. So I'm hoping that that means that the story will turn out to be as good as everybody has gotten from the manga. I don't mind it so much watching them side by side, because the manga is not like crazy animation, because it's a manga and they're capturing all the panels anyways. So maybe I'm just getting like a motion manga with good voice acting. So I've been loving it. I'm really looking forward to each episode. It's definitely has my fascination. It's already hitting me with some intriguing stuff that's possibilities for going forward. And I'm already loving speculating on what they could possibly, how they can possibly twist the characters. So yeah, good stuff so far. Lucifer and the Biscuit Hammer. Again, Naz, not great animation, but the story is going to be there. I'm assuming the story is going to be there, so I'm loving it. So moving on, Extreme Hearts. This one is streaming on Crunchyroll. I don't know how long it's running for. It's being done by Seven Arcs. Sources and original, probably a multimedia project with some mobile apps and stuff. Genres are sports, and this one, the creator is Masaki Suzuki, who's of course known for doing Dog Days and Magical Lyrica Nonoha. So this one follows Hiyori, and Hiyori is a failed idol. She's been just recently let go from her idol manager group. Things aren't working out. She's tried. She's made her debut and everything, but she's not successful enough, so they're letting her go. But in passing words, they kind of said, you know, look, I still want you to succeed. Like, this manager, like, legit says, you know, I really want you to seek your dreams. So there's another option. There's this thing called Extreme Hearts, this, like, extreme sports group that their whole thing is that you play sports with these, like, enhancement shoes and stuff like that. It's very futuristic sports kind of stuff. And you also get to perform on a stage after each of these sports events. So that could be your way of getting out there and getting out your song out to the world, is playing a sports game and singing. So one of her favorite fans, Saki, who has always been listening to her music, she kind of tells her, no, don't do that, because I did that once and it was terrible. All that work and all that experience, all that effort we put into it just to fail, it was heartbreaking, and you're not very sportsy, you shouldn't do that. You're just gonna really just kind of not wanting Hiyori to fail. She was kind of trying to talk her out of it, but Hiyori keeps going off with it, and then eventually Saki gets her friend Sumika to help Hiyori kind of establish what she needs to establish, train what she needs to train, get the equipment she needs, and eventually join the Extreme Hearts. To which Hiyori runs out into Extreme Hearts, starts to play in the competition, is quickly getting her butt kicked, and then Saki and Sumika jump onto the field because apparently they're allowed to, and they play along with Hiyori. And so you kind of have this dynamic where Hiyori is good at singing and performing, so whenever it comes to them actually performing on stage after the events, Hiyori is the one that's kind of guiding them and helping them with the stage performance and practicing. Whereas when it comes to the actual sports side of things, the extreme sports, Saki and Sumika are kind of trying to help Hiyori. Hiyori's kind of quirk is that she's really good at, like, speed, but she just doesn't know how to control it. But Saki and Sumika have the knowledge of the sports themselves to kind of carry her. So, your thoughts? Didn't watch Lucifer and the Biscuit Hammer, but he watched Extreme Hearts. Jeez.
I've generally enjoyed myself watching the show. It hasn't really done anything that I find fascinating. I think the sports are kind of cool to see how they integrate the enhanced features of, like, Hiyori running a little bit faster with her boots or whatever have you, or jumping when they jump a little bit higher, or they that stuff's kind of fun and cool, and incorporating the idol nature of it is interesting. It's one of those things of you kind of want one or the other, the extreme sports or the idol side of it. And so you don't really know if I should dock it because of the whole extreme sports thing, or should I dock it for the idol side? It's like neither of them are really doing anything phenomenal. They just are. It's just a weird, it's one of those that I guess it's a weird quirk of this show that you kind of just go, huh, that's interesting, and take it for what it is. I don't think it's gonna make the top charts of anybody's list. It's just, it is what it is.
I think that's where I kind of fall in it, is that it's trying to do too many things at once that it never does anything good. I think the characters are fine. Like I think Saki is just absolutely adorable. I love their character designs. The visually, it looks great. The sports scenes themselves are decently animated. And yes, technically they don't, or at least for this time, they didn't use CGI for the performance. So you got one up on Shaft. hey, Shaft, check out Seven Arcs. They'd actually animate stuff. I'm going to do that every now and then. but no, like I agree with the idea that it seems like it's trying to do... It still, at its core, has these three girls coming together for a goal. And I think the quirk that it does have is having one person that's good at this thing that can help the other two, and these two being good at this thing and helping her out at the same time. That's kind of the unique thing that it has in there, but at the same time, again, it's doing too many things at once. They literally are doing every sport. Extreme Hearts is every sport. So these girls are not just football players. They're not just soccer ball players. They're everything. They have to play everything, which doesn't make any sense to me in the end. But at the same time, there's nothing happening at these sports events that's like, oh my gosh, plot twist. The only plot twist we've had so far was that for some reason Saki and Sumika was able to just jump on the field. Like, they pre-established Hiyori is going to do this, so she has nothing but AI players on her side, and she's not winning. So for some reason, Saki and Sumika can just jump on the field and start playing with her because she's failing. And the broadcasters like just goes along with it. Oh, by the way, Saki and Sumika that just entered the field, they're these two girls. And it's like, wait, so why is this allowed? Isn't this like an official competition? I mean, it kind of hints that Sumika registered them behind their backs and didn't tell anybody, which I don't know how she would be able to do that, but it's just kind of, it's fine. It's not really doing anything. Like I said, it's doing too much that it can't focus too much, but it's at the same time not terrible. It's just not super entertaining. So if you're looking for a sports show that, if you're looking for another Pretty Derby,
and that's exactly what I thought of, is the Pretty Derby. It's doing exactly the same thing as Pretty Derby. I mean, sports, they would do a sing. Sport, and then they go and sing the idol song. So.
Yeah. So there you go. Is it wrong to try to pick up girls in a dungeon season 4? Oh my gosh, we're at season 4 now. This is streaming on HIDIVE. I've heard a lot of people say it's going to run for 2 cores. I think I confirmed that. But yeah, I think it's going to run for 2 cores. Studio is JC Staff still. Source is a light novel. This basically, for those that are not familiar, takes place in this one world where the goddesses and the gods decided they wanted to kind of hang out with humans so that they are given the ability to give up their powers as gods and goddesses to live amongst the humans. And they kind of create different, what they call familia, which are different kind of guilds where adventurers can join under them, and they will grant them additional bonuses to then go into this big, great labyrinth that's in the middle of this town and go far enough into the labyrinth that they can and level up and get stronger. We follow Belle, who at the time of the series starts, he's the only member of Hestia Familia, which Hestia Bestia. I don't think Hestia wanted anybody else to join the guild, honestly. If she could have had it her way, I think we would have 4 seasons of it just being the two of them. But things happen. A lot of things have happened every season. As every season, we get more waifus and more waifus added to the collection. And yeah, now we're getting into season 4. A lot of it has to do with the previous season, which was a lot to do with this, the monsters of this world. Them realizing at some point that some of these monsters of this world are sentient. They can speak. They're somebody you can converse with and not fight against. And so as we're getting into season 4, the focus right now, based on what has happened through his conversation with Fels and stuff, is that his new goal, Bell's new goal, is to reach the bottom of the labyrinth, to reach the final goal of the labyrinth, because at the end of it, they don't want to say what, at the end of it, is something that will make this stop happening. Like, if we can reach that point, we no longer have to have this whole situation. People will not longer have to go to labyrinth or something. I don't know what it is. There's something there, and it will undo things. So he has to do it. So he basically forms a big party. They get a decree from the guild to go down there and collect some stuff. And so he forms a party of pretty much a lot of people that he's gathered over the last few seasons and heads down to the labyrinth. So your thoughts
Except
so
for
far?
Eyes. He didn't take eyes for some odd reason.
We don't need eyes.
It only really has been like two, maybe three episodes. So it has been kind of, we're just getting into it. And I do love the fact that it feels like us getting back into the dungeon. In a way, it really feels like we're going into the dungeon, and there feels like there's a bit of a weight going on. It's trying to put more emphasis on, hey, you remember that dungeon thing? It was important for a reason, and now we're actually seeing it. We've got some something that happened in this last episode that kind of shoved it right up in front of you that, no, this is not a nice and happy place that Bell made it out to be on floor 4 when you're at floor 23. I do love the fact that they're actually feels like they're putting that back into play. At the same time, seeing a lot of our favorite characters come back into the forefront and get involved in there, and the acknowledgement of, hey, a lot of things have happened over the time. Bell is quote unquote maturing. I assume until we see Bell turn back into a crybaby, we'll decide at that point.
Yeah, like this last episode was like all about everybody relying on him, and it's like this is setting up something.
But yeah, I like that we're getting back into the swing of things, the new weight that has been added back to the dungeon, and supposedly characters are growing, and so we will see where we go from here.
I think that one of our biggest arguments about Danmachi series as a whole was the fact that they leave stuff behind, and then suddenly, like, the first scene that we get in the season is suddenly they look at his stats again, and he's leveled, like, a whole bunch. So it's like, it makes you wonder, like, this whole time, has it just been this build-up to now suddenly all the experience registers, and he suddenly levels a whole bunch? And I've been hearing, ever since my first impressions of this season, like, so many people are like, dude, there is that way because they're adapting it wrong. Like, apparently he doesn't forget things. It's just that they've been adapting it wrong this entire time. A lot of people claiming that or saying that apparently the creator is now involved with this fourth season adaptation. It's apparently supposed to be the best arc of the entire light novel. And again, it's supposed to be going for two cores rather than the typical one core. So everybody's saying all the things that I want to hear. So if that's all true, then this could possibly be the best season of this series so far, and I'm perfectly happy with accepting that if that's the case, because I've been kind of slowly cooling down on Danmachi as a series as a whole. It's been kind of turning into every season is a new waifu. Now, granted, that said, the OP seems to indicate that there is going to be a waifu in this one too, and it's a mermaid girl, so we'll see if it turns into focusing just on this one mermaid girl. Like every season has done, here's a new waifu, everything is about that waifu, the waifu is acquired, the season ends, here's this new waifu, everything's focused on this waifu kind of thing. But we'll see. Like I said, I hope that the rumors are true that it's going to be the best arc. So far, it's been pretty solid. I think the first episode was a solid reintroduction to all the characters. Again, like Chris said, showing how each one of them has grown. I like the emphasis that was put on Lily and the idea that she technically has not grown much because she is a support. Supports don't get experience. She's still a level one. They're going to the deepest part of the labyrinth, and she's literally going to get one shot down there. So emphasizing the idea that she has to figure out a way of supporting without being near the front line, I think is really fantastic, because I've always loved Lily as a character. She's always been one of my favorite characters of the show, and to see her trying to figure out somewhere where she can apply herself is great. And then we think we had that with every character. Haruhime technically Aisha, you know, bestowing upon her, look, your only benefit is giving him a level up. So you need to figure out other ways that you can benefit the party. And so kind of bringing this grimoire, showing her ways that she can be a support caster is great. And they did that with every character. And I like that they almost had like this growth period within an episode. They didn't feel like everybody was getting these gigantic leaps. Everybody was getting this one thing that would progress them to benefit them in this larger goal for the story going forward. The chemistry is being set up already. Again, technically the second episode was a lot of emphasis on everybody being so reliant on Bell's progression. He's so much more stronger now. He's definitely coming through as somebody people can rely on. And I think that's going to probably blow up in their face eventually. I think somebody mentioned the idea that it was Aisha specifically. She's putting this emphasis on him that, you know, if everybody relies on you too much, the moment you fall, we're all dead. And I thought that for a moment there, she was going to mention the idea of don't be reckless, because if you die, we die. But at least it's acknowledging the idea that they're putting too much emphasis upon him. And I think that that'll probably, it's probably built to blow up in his face, but we'll see. We'll see what it does. Chigusa is already in danger. I don't like that. So hopefully Chigusa is good. We'll see though. I'm excited. I'm hyped because of the hype. Hopefully the hype doesn't kill it. hopefully everybody's not lying, and hopefully it doesn't fall apart outside of everybody's expectations. I think that's the main thing. I want people to get their expectations met. So we'll see. Is it wrong to try to pick up Girls on Dungeon season 4, waifu number 4? Check that out if that's interesting to you. Next one we have is Futopai. This is I think it was our last new show this season. But Futopai, this one, Futo Tentai. This one's streaming on Crunchyroll, running for 12 episodes, done by Studio Kai. The source is a manga, and the genres are action, mystery, supernatural. I think this legit just premiered yesterday. So this is a way late starter. Did you get a chance to check it out?
No.
Okay. So this one's apparently the self-proclaimed hard-boiled detective Shotaro Hidari. And it opens up with this kind of, music video of him seeing his father dying. He gets something from a briefcase and turns into a Super Sentai character and fights a bunch of people as his dad falls down inside this building that's crumbling and explodes. I don't know if that's something that happened in the past. I don't know if that's something happening in the future. I know he hasn't transformed yet, so I'm assuming this is something that's going to happen in the future. Anyways, that aside, again, he proclaims that he's this hard-boiled detective, just like his father once was. I don't know if his father's dead. Again, I don't know if that's a past or the future. But either way, he is a detective, and he wants to be a hard-boiled detective. Eventually, he runs into this witch on the side of this dock who asks if he's the one that will satisfy her, and he dodges her, and then she disappears. And then he gets this guy that shows up at his detective agency that wants him to try to find a witch. And the way he describes it sounds just like the girl that he just ran into, this very beautiful girl. So he seeks out to try to find her, eventually ends up finding her. She flees and disappears. They end up kind of finding that this one area, there was a murder that happened, and people describe the murderer as being this witch. So now he kind of has to get the police involved, eventually finds her. But then every time he seems to find her, in chasing her, he gets transported to some sort of alternate dimension that is different than Futo, the actual town that he's in. So, and every time he comes out of that dimension, he seems to be somewhere else. So seems to be some kind of magic. I don't know. We haven't established if it's this witch that's causing this transportation, but it doesn't seem, it seems like she's being used somehow. So the other aspect that's in this area of this town is that there's this thing they're called memories, which are things that can cause magic somehow, but they haven't explained that yet either. So a lot of things aren't explained at this point. We're only one episode in. Barely anything's explained at this point. Visually, it looks fine. It's got an interesting style to it. It's got almost a lush style to the characters and everything. A lot of detail to some of the characters, which I think is great. Tokime, the witch, is pretty smoking, and they're liking showing her. But I don't know. It's got a decent chemistry so far, because again, Shotaro is just kind of a doofball detective guy. He's very confident in himself. He's very dandy, I guess, is the best way to put it. Which I don't know if dandy and hardboiled is the same. I don't think it's the same. He's very dandy. He claims that he's parboiled. He's very dandy, though. But it's good. It's a, for first episode, it's a pretty decent setup so far. And again, it looks decently visually. The chase scene with the motorcycle was rough because you had basically 2D animated girl running from a CGI biker. But other than that, it's mostly been pretty solid looking. I don't know what it's going to do from here, but we'll see going forward. But pretty solid start so far. But that's my impressions on one episode. So check that out if you're looking for dandy. Check out Futapai. There you go. And our last one we have is Aoashi. Did you get caught up on this one yet, Chris?
No.
No!
Working on another
we'll
show.
We'll see. We'll see if we can push Chris into this one after he gets done with the other one. This one's streaming on Crunchyroll for 24 episodes. And again, we're technically... I'm at 17 now, so we're just about done at this point. But I won't reveal too much stuff. I will say that this has been a really fantastic show so far. For those that don't know what it is, essentially, Ashito, he was a part of this out-in-the-sticks soccer team. Eventually, at some point, he gets scouted by this guy that's a part of like this Tokyo branch, Fukuda. And he's scouted to come to this competition where essentially they do have like the junior highs and stuff. They can, if they're the lower ranks or the lower year of schooling of soccer players, if they do well enough, they will graduate into the higher years of soccer players. But also at the same time, this Fukuda guy will go around and scout out other players from other schools to find like really talented people and bring them in as well. And that actually comes into a story play later on, which was very interesting. But Ashito ends up being scouted. He goes to this tryout, ends up passing. You go with this whole situation where technically his family is really poor, and so they can't really afford to pay for him to go to some, you know, Tokyo school, living expenses and all that kind of stuff. But his mother kind of figures it out. Like, she sits down with this girl named Hana and really does situate, you know, can they afford it, what's all needed, and puts in the extra effort, extra jobs, just to make it to where Ashito can essentially seek out his dreams of being a soccer player. Really quickly, what happens is now that he's at the school, he gets his face rubbed in the dirt constantly because his whole gameplay style has always been he's a forward. He will always be up there, the attacker, basically getting to the goal. His whole thing is, get me the ball, I'll get to the goal. Give me the ball, I'll get to the goal. Now he has to learn that his other teammates are good. Like, his previous school, nobody was good at soccer. They just knew that if they can get him the ball, he'll win. And so now he has to learn how to actually play soccer. That's really the key thing here. And so as it goes along, what you're really seeing is, again, Ashito realizing his shortcomings. Him having to learn lessons on how to actually play soccer, how to work with other people, the frustrations he causes because of his lack of knowledge, and ultimately discovering why Fukuda chose him. Like, what is actually special about him? What it's always kind of played out for the most of the entirety of the first core was that Ashito's special ability was that he can, it kind of portrays it as this bird flying above the field, and that he can basically know where everybody is at on the field. But eventually at some point you get a realization that Fukuda has been lying to Ashita the whole time. Like, the reason why he brought him there wasn't what he initially told him. And it turns this whole character turning point where you realize, oh, this is where we're going. Like, this is what he wanted Ashita for. And I think that the writer is kind of has a lot of guts for kind of being willing to take the character in that direction. And I really wasn't expecting it to go in that direction. What this series has always... I'll be perfectly honest. What this series does well is characters. And if you are a sports fan, unless you're in my kind of wheelhouse, you probably disagree with this. I never like sports shows unless the characters are good. Unless the drama outside of the field drives me to want to know what will happen on the field. I need to understand characters before I see them compete against each other. And this has done that very well. The thing that this does differently than most other shows is that at least until like the 16th episode, maybe late 16th, we've never really cared too much about who they're competing against. They're now finally bringing in characters that they will compete against that have character-driven stories behind them. For the most part, it's always been about the team itself, Ashito, his teammates, and their growth together, which has been the driving force for my story, enjoyment of the story. Yeah, technically everything surrounding Ashito and his family, their money struggles, the willingness that his mother's going through to support him, the driving force in him that he wants to not fail because otherwise everything that his mother's doing for him is going to go to waste. Hana and her support of him and his mother has been phenomenal. They finally introduced another flower, which is Anri, who is like this daughter of one of the main sponsors of this team. Her like dedication to the sport itself. I love this whole scene where she's like ball dribbling, what they call it, where they foot dribble the ball up and down and stuff like that. I was like, holy crap, this girl knows how to play soccer. It was really cool because they have this like this really this basically Ojo, like this princess girl, and she's got a butler that's always following them around, and yet she's sitting here just kicking the soccer ball around like a pro. It was like really cool. Really changed my perspective on that character. I think the other thing that really does blow me away through going in the second core is how you can have certain characters that seem like they're the bad guy, and then at some point realizing they're not the bad guy, and yet not feel cheesy. It not feel like they were purposely trying to trick me is phenomenal. One character, literally from the get-go, the moment that they were introduced, felt like a jerk. And I didn't understand why he was acting the way he was. And like I said, instead of at some point going, haha, I tricked you this whole time, they were actually the good guy, it was all in perspective. And how the writer pulled that off, I was blown away. Like, I immediately, the moment that I realized it, I was like, I had to tweet out, like, how can they turn a villain into a good guy in a split second blows me away. But yeah, great characters, fantastic story moments, so much great drama. How they're incorporating this kind of quote-unquote superpower of Ashito into the story is, sometimes it feels kind of a little too much into the world of Supernatural, but at the same time, it makes sense in a way to the story itself. So it doesn't feel too out of place into a world of reality. But I think the only thing that I have a complaint about the show overall is just whenever Ashito gets something in his head, he gets stuck on it. And so you'll have a lot of these really repetitive moments where he keeps trying to do something until he figures it out. And it turns into everybody just yelling at him constantly that he's screwing up because he always does it in the middle of a match. So he'll figure out, like, oh, this one really great player looks left and right a bunch. I got to figure out what he's looking for. So I'm going to sit here and keep looking around while we're having a match. And he keeps doing that. And it does that for like an entire episode. And it's like, please stop screwing up the entire match trying to do something you don't understand. I understand you have to keep doing something in order to figure out how to do it. But when you don't have no clue what you're doing, and all you're doing is just making an idiot of yourself and screwing up the game for everybody else, it gets so frustrating. And Ashito gets really dumb like that at times. He's definitely kind of an airheaded main character to every now and then that really frustrates me. So, but yeah, I love it to death, though. It's easily one of my favorite sports anime in a long time, and I cannot wait to see. Hopefully it has a really solid conclusion after these two arcs, or a second season announcement. So yeah, highly recommend if you're looking for a sports show that's not too much about the sports. It's more about the characters. So yeah, Awashi, check that out. That's it. That's all the shows of the summer 2022 anime seasons. Hope you guys enjoyed all these first impressions. If you did, if you're on YouTube, make sure you hit that like button. Otherwise, you can support us by letting people know about us. Definitely does help us out. We definitely appreciate everybody that listens to us and supports us through either our Patreon, our tips link, or just letting people know about us. The word of mouth definitely does help us out. Definitely appreciate you guys' support, and y'all take care. Os! から夜が好きだった口に出るのはなんか嫌だった何となくただもったいなかったお前のことがもっと知りたかったいわゆる三文の得だけ打ってでも見たいのさもっと奥の奥の奥広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く広く
け差が似合うその黒い肌に吸い込まれて垂れて招き覚めるままにそれからお前はお学校くれたしお菜の裸も見してくれたのだことで酒に口づけて音のタバコくすね気をつけたやっちゃいけないが溢れて知っちゃいけないにまみれてる迎えに来る闇に紛れてお前はいつも気まぐれで夜更かし